And welcome back to another episode of the TetraCast. This is RPG Site's weekly podcast where we get the site staff together to talk about our favorite genre of video games. I'm your host. My name is Brian Vitale. Joining me, we've got the usual crew here with me once again. I have Josh Torres.
91 hours later, I finished Rebirth.
Adam Vitale.
Hello.
James Colizio.
Hey, folks.
And Chow Min Wu.
I'm dead.
I don't know why Chow's dead, but we are all here. We are recording this on March 9th, and basically the hits won't stop coming, and they keep coming, or I don't know how you say that saying.
But there's a lot of stuff coming. Okay, go on.
Yeah, so we have a lot of new games to talk about, and we literally just came off the back of Rebirth last week as a big release for obviously the site for the whole year, and I know several people are still working our way through that. Yeah, Josh said he had like 90 hours. I had pre-release, so I was like writing up guide notes and things like that. I think I was at like 140. It's a big game, so no surprise that we have people still working on that one. We have two new games that released this in the last week that we want to talk about on this podcast. And then we also have a lot of game announcements this week that we weren't really expecting. So basically, as expected, the back end of the year is starting to fill up. Even though some of these announcements we don't have clear dates on yet, we're starting to learn a little bit more about what's coming in the future and what we have to look forward to. So pretty big, surprisingly big news day today. But before we go into the news, the two games in the last week that we wanted to talk about were the release of The Thaumaturge and Unicorn Overlord. These are both games that I know several of us here have touched on. Obviously, the Unicorn Overlord had the demo a few weeks back, so some of us got started on that. A reviewer is still working our way through that game, but we have a couple people that have played both the demo and the full release and are willing to talk about that. But prior to that, we're going to start off with talking about the release of The Thaumaturge, another game that we just put up the review for the website in the last week. And I believe Josh is going to take point on this, though Adam has also started playing it. I'm not sure who else has. But we'll go ahead and start with that one. So I'll hand it off over to Josh to start out with. About exactly what, tee this up for us, what is The Thaumaturge, and what were your thoughts on it, and just lead us through your thoughts on the game.
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting RPG. This is made by developer Fool's Theory. They are a Polish-based studio, and most people will now know them for, they are the developers of the upcoming Witcher remake. That was announced by CD Projekt Red several months ago, and they're developers on that. So, you know, as we're waiting for that remake for the first Witcher from them, they released a turn-based RPG that's set in a pretty interesting time frame. It is set in 1905 Warsaw amidst the first Russian Revolution, not the one in 1917, which is the one that most people will be familiar with. And this centers around this character named Viktor Shulsky. Sorry for my pronunciation for any, you know, names here. I'm not from that region. But the main thing about this game is that it's historical fiction in the sense that it is very grounded in reality in terms of like the state of society at that time frame, but it is fiction because your character essentially has the power to create pacts with demons, and so it has a supernatural twist on this period in history. The story, after like a brief opening segment that introduces you to the mechanics of the game, which I'll get into, the main story is you go back to Warsaw after hearing news of your father passing away, and he died under pretty mysterious circumstances. So the core story is finding out what's surrounding this whole death, you know, what happened, essentially. So The Thaumaturge is a really smartly designed game, I'd say, because it's really not about like going to combat encounters a lot. Especially early on, you don't really get into many combat encounters. It is very much, as I put it in my review and like the blurb of it, it's like it's sometimes as much of a documentary as much as it is a video game, where you're exploring various districts around Warsaw and going on investigations, hunting for clues, but also just learning much about like the state of Warsaw in that time, because you'll see a lot of collectibles in the environment. It could be journal entries, could be newspaper articles. It could also be like objects of interest, because your profession as a thaumaturge, as one that can like forge packs with demons and have this supernatural power is sometimes there will be objects in the environment where you can get like lingering sentiments, feelings, sometimes even memories from people who last like held that object. So you kind of gain an introspective on other characters in the world, what they thought about, like, you know, the world around and circumstances around them through these objects. And this is all dictated by four central stats on whether you get like to see these traits on these objects. That's kind of the bare kind of the surface level on it. And the thing that really compelled me about this whole thing is not just about like investigations and stuff, but also like even the battle system is really, really done well, I think, in this game, where it's a timeline-based, turn-based RPG, where it's all like your playable characters in your party are very limited. It's only Victor and is the summoned demon. And only Victor has life bar, your demon does not. And enemies hit pretty hard. Like, one of the interesting things I found about this game when I first booted up is like the default difficulty is actually on challenging, which is the hard equivalent. It's like, okay, the developers really are encouraging this, so I'll keep it on challenging. And so your Victor can't take much damage, obviously, as a result of this. And you have to really think about incoming enemy attacks. You see when enemies are attacking the next two turns ahead of you. You have current turn, the next turn, then the turn after that. And you'll see the order of actions. You, your demon, and all the other people around you are about to take on you. So you're tasked with trying to deal as much damage as you can while minimizing the amount of damage that you're about to receive. And you can do that with various ways. You can slow them, which will push their actions back. You can interrupt them, which will break their actions. You can do all sorts of stuff that kind of has an effect on like the incoming turns, like maybe inflicting a status ailment that will allow you to do more damage or more focus bar damage to them, because once you deplete a focus bar, you can have access to a super attack. So it's really all about making like good tactical decisions to make sure that like you're not going to be able to negate all damage, but what are the safest options to make sure that you're disabling enemy combatants that are the most the ones that pose the most threat at that moment, and you're working around that. And then as you progress throughout the game, you'll get more different demons that have different specialties to help bolster your capabilities in combat. So on top of that, like, you know, you have a really like well-designed combat system along with this world that you're exploring and learning more about, not just that from a game perspective, more as like also historical curiosity as well. We'll talk more about characters later, but I want to know where Adam, how far he is into the game and what he thinks so far as well on this.
I think at the end of Act One, and okay. So I think I got a pretty good, you know, taste of like the flow and the style and the structure of the game. And you're right in that it's a good mix. Like, a lot of the game structure itself is not combat focused. It's a ton of interlocking quests and investigations, and there's a big focus on like learning things about the characters, about, you know, the world. And you're getting quests and pop-ups and notifications and everything everywhere. And in a good way, there's a lot of interlocking like people and objectives and factions and things like that. And it's easy to get distracted in terms of like trying to follow different leads. But it's not that the combat is, you know, slacking. Every combat encounter you do get into, like you said, it's actually pretty tactical in that, all right, there's only one of me and there's three enemies. You want to mitigate damage as much as possible. So, like, I want to try to interrupt an attack here. Maybe I can put on a status effect here. I can heal myself this turn and then make sure I try to cancel the next attack. and you're really paying attention to the timeline, trying to make sure that you're trying to be as efficient as possible. And so you have to be pretty thorough in trying to determine what you do first and when you have a free turn to maybe heal or whatever. And the healing is not a lot. The few different attacks you get where you can heal. I have 4 Salyutters right now, and I guess there's like 8 total, maybe 12, if I remember.
It's 8, yeah.
8, okay. 2 per.
It's interesting because it's 4 mandatory ones and like 4 optional ones. Like you could actually like permanently miss out on like some Salyutors here and there. And there's like half of them are just like you can just choose not to get there for not interacting like with the side quest to potentially get them, because sometimes the results of your decisions may or may not factor into whether you obtain the Salyutor.
So how do I put this? The game is a lot of running, like I think you put this in your review. It is a lot of just like, it's a very RPG in terms of a lot of dialogue, a lot of, you know, choices and discussions. And there's already a few things that I've seen where I wonder like, man, I kind of bungled that, or, you know, I maybe made some decisions that kind of came back at me in ways I didn't really expect. And like, I wonder what would have happened if I maybe did something else, or I talked to a different person, or what have you. And so it's honestly really interesting. And it is sort of like detective-ish, because you're trying to, your main objective, at least for me right now, is trying to figure out why your dad, like, you learn circumstances around his death were a little bit odd, so you're trying to figure out what exactly happened here. And you haven't seen your dad, your character, in like 15 years, so there's things about him that you're not really familiar with, and trying to learn exactly who his enemies were, and you meet some mysterious people. But then, like, every other, like, main side quest in the game revolving a Salyutor is also sort of, like, detective-ish and trying to figure out, you know, what exactly is going on for, like, these different events that you see. But it's really cool. I think it's a really good mix of the tactical combat that you do get into. There's not a lot of combat, and I think that's actually a good thing in terms of you're not just overwhelmed with battle after battle after battle. And you gain most of your experience by doing the questing and the dialogue and finding things on the map. There are a lot of collectibles, like more than, there's hundreds. And so it can be a little bit overwhelming, like just picking up everything. And
when you say collectibles, what do you mean? Like they're like numbered on a menu, or
some of them are. Yeah, there's like gramophone records which are counted. There's sketches that are counted. There's
the journal, like the journal stuff, like the collectible entries in this game, like the descriptions are like really well done in this game too. Like just like what they have to say about like the things that you pick up.
But there's also things that like there's also so the main thing is you pick up different. I think they're called observations. And it can sometimes you can sometimes get them from talking to people, or sometimes by picking things up. And then once you put together like 3 or 4 observations that are connected, there'll actually be a pop-up that your character makes a conclusion. And based on your conclusions that you collect, that'll unlock different dialogue choices and different basically options for how you progress a quest. And it's pretty cool. Like it's very RPG in that sense, where you know, depending on what you find and who you talk to and what you say, there are going to be certain options that you won't be able to do. And like literally, the game is pretty open. How do I put this? It actually will even tell you, like, there's a dialogue option here, but you can't do it because of the choices you made. Like, it's kind of telling you there was another route here, but you can't do it because of choices you made. It doesn't tell you exactly why, but it tells you that there were other options. And I actually kind of like that, because it makes it very obvious that I wasn't just basically shoehorned into this one path. Like, okay, the path I'm on is just one of several in how I could have approached this quest. And it's because it tells me there are other things that I could have done, even though I don't know exactly what they were. And like if they didn't tell me that, I wouldn't have. There's no way I would have known. Like maybe it always just sort of funnels to this outcome, I wouldn't have known. So I kind of like that.
Well, that's
that
one thing when we review RPGs. Sometimes we're like,
well, I only what have were the other outcomes. I don't know. Once.
Were there other outcomes? Are they just different flavor of the same outcome, or are they drastically different? And there's still a little bit of this here where you won't know exactly how those other routes would have turned out until you, unless you were able to play through it twice. But at least it doesn't hide it. It's like, hey, you know, these your choices matter here. It's not just for flavor. It's like there could be significant changes. The way you're describing it, I've not played the Thaumaturge yet, but I literally just downloaded it to my PC as you guys were talking. Is it reminds me of early game. This is a strange comparison, but it's the comparison that comes to mind. Early game Elex, where you have like three or four or five different factions that are all interlocking. And you're like, I don't know who I should help first or second or third. And I've got like five quests that all talk to the same like group of people, but they all have kind of different consequences depending on what I do. And it's almost frustrating, but in a good way, where it's a little bit of like, I have a lot of choices. I guess I just kind of have to go with one. Like it's like the optimal path is not obvious.
Yeah.
So therefore you just kind of have to pick one.
Yeah. This is the sort of game where you don't want to try to like,
optimize it,
like do an optimal playthrough. There's so many interlocking like objectives and quests. It's really the type of game kind of like, it's the type of game where you just want to just make your decisions in the moment and see what happens, you know? Don't try to be like, oh, I'm trying to min-max your like outcome to get the most experience or the most of conclusions made or the most optimal outcome. Just, it's not, the game is...
Well, that's similar to the discussion that you had about Banishers.
Yeah, in a way. I actually like this way, this game's quest design much more than Banishers, because Banishers, like I said when I talked about it and in my review, it tells you this choice leads to this outcome, this choice leads to this ending. Where this game, I have no idea what the ending of the game is. I'm not targeting an ending. It's just like in the moment making decisions based on the characters and the scenarios that I'm seeing, and I'm assuming there will be different outcomes depending on what I pick, but I don't know what they are. I'm not aiming for something. Does that make sense? Whereas
What I was getting at when I brought it up, because in Banishers you said like, well, one of these outcomes leads to a certain ending that I know I want, and one of these outcomes leads to a certain ending that I know I don't want. Therefore, the choice is made for me. Where it sounds like with the way that the Thaumaturge is set up, you've got choices laid out in front of you, and you're not sure where they'll lead. So you really do have to make like a decision at the moment, not something where you're trying to fit a certain shape into a place depending on where you want to go.
Yeah, how I describe this phenomenon in the how the game treats this is delicate ambiguity in its quest design, where it'll tell you enough of like sometimes when you make a decision with a character, they'll say this character will remember this at the time. You don't know what how this will affect things later on. It doesn't tell you that. And like Adam already mentioned, like some dialogue options will be locked, saying because of your actions, this option is locked. You don't know where like what prior events could have led because you don't know what that option is. It doesn't tell you. It doesn't have that option spelled out and then grayed out. It deliberately doesn't tell you what that option was at all. And I think that's a really like it works to the strength of the game because it's kind of giving you that feeling of like that there's no right or wrong options. It's just you make a decision and you live with the consequences. And I think I'm really happy that they went with that decision rather than like trying to spell it out for you of like where you went wrong, rather, right? Or what could be considered as quote unquote wrong, depending on like what kind of like how you wanted the events to unfold in your head. Because like this game is probably, I'd say 70% dialogue and investigation phase and 30% combat, if I were to give a sign up percentages, like how much of the game you interact with on a moment-to-moment basis. And I think they struck a really nice balance because this is such a personal story and character narratively driven game based on like how the characters interact with each other. This is not like some narrator or overhead person telling you what's happening. It's like it's really kind of putting you into the moment-to-moment of like this is why characters do the things they do in this game. And the nice thing about that is like they don't have the because of how a Thaumaturge can kind of learn about characters indirectly through these observations and all through the lingering feelings and memories in the objects that they've interacted with, you kind of get indirectly know a person without having them spell it out for you in dialogue. So that's kind of the nice thing, that conversation flow in this game feels much more natural because characters don't have to go out of their way unnaturally or inorganically to tell you, oh, this is why I do the things that I do and this is what I'm fighting for. You know what I'm saying? Which is, you know, a common thing that that some RPGs experience because they don't know how to like tell players that like this is why characters are doing the things that they want. This game is able to bypass that in a really creative way. And I think that really works to the strength of like it's the writing in this game in general. So I think
it's just a specific example, but I think I get what you're saying in terms of like in other RPGs, there might be a dialogue tree, but because it is a video game, you have to tee up the player as fast as possible. So they'll just kind of offer a lot of information very quickly in a way that might feel manufactured for the benefit of the player. Like, oh, I need to tell you what side this person's on or what they know or what they don't or where they come from.
Think about, there's a really, I don't know why this example popped in my head, but think about the Juju main story quest in Xenoblade, you know? Mm-hmm. Like the writing of that is like, I am doing this because this is my background and this is, I'm doing this because, you know, this is part of like who I was when I was growing up, you know, stuff like that. And it's like, in the moment, it's like, it's not offensive or like egregious. It's just like, but it's definitely like, this is a video game. I have to tell you who I am and because you're meeting me for the first time. And this is like my life story kind of condensed. And please go do this next thing now that you know a little bit more about me. And it's very mechanical in that way. Not to say that it's bad or it's wrong, but it has to make that concession in dialogue for this story beat to work, to make sense at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that. And the Thaumaturge, because of the setting and the character they have, they're like, well, we can actually treat this slightly differently because we have someone who can glean the information from objects, and therefore we can leverage that.
Yeah, and there's certainly from like a modern view on it now, a contemporary standpoint, a lot of this cast is, arguably all of the cast is flawed in their own way because of how society viewed certain things at a certain time period. There's definitely like open discrimination against other races in this time period. There's definitely social class tension during this time period. There are certain, you know, for example, there's gonna be like a quest line in the game where there's meetings about the benefits of having better societal standing for women held in secret, because if you were to teach that openly, you know, the police would come after you. You know, that's something that's explored in this game, but it's not trying to like be the be all end all to fix it, but it's more of an acknowledgement. This is something that happened in this time period, and these were the consequences that people had to risk in order to like acknowledge this in society in some way, shape, or form. And you know, and I think Fool's Theory like has like establishes that trust with the player, because there's a Polish based studio, and I mentioned in my review, I imagine because they're a Polish based studio, I assume a large chunk of their staff are either Polish or have Polish roots. And you can tell in this game that they've done a ton of research around this time period to like accurately convey what the situation was at that time period. You know, like you had Russian Russian military occupation, you know, on Polish territory because of that, of the events that were unfolding during the Russian Revolution at that time. And so they have to craft this tension and like, and also think about like various perspectives. Because it's not like it's not a black or white situation among the populace. It's like different people have different perspectives on what's happening on that time period, and also based on their background as well, on why they held these views at that time. And they strike that balance surprisingly well. I'm really astounded, but like, wow, the writing in this game is really, really solid. You know, it'd be so easy to fuck this up, but they don't. That's incredible. I want to sing like so many praises for this game, but it's so tough during this like during this time where like there's so many great RPGs coming out left and right, and like, and I hope this game gets its own chance to shine among people, and hopefully, like, you know, when people are able to find time throughout the year to, like, you know, pick up a try out an RPG, I hope they consider this, because I think there's such a, it is such a unique novel RPG. Like, it's just, I can't think of any other RPG in the last 5 to 6 years that's like this game, I guess.
I'm looking up right now, like, what else Fool's Theory has done.
They've done another game called Seven, I believe, before this. I think there's their second project.
I actually played a little bit of that. Seven was kind of RPG-ish, but I thought of it more almost like a tactical game, like straight tactical.
Mm-hmm.
But I that was, you know, it was a long time ago, and I think I only ever played like 4 hours of it, so I'm not an expert. But
yeah. So, and I mentioned, like, you know, I think there are going to be aspects about this game that you see on its surface, and it's like, oh, this looks like Shin Megami Tensei or Persona. And, you know, and in some respects, it kind of is, because of the whole demon, like, you know, working with demons too, you know, in turn-based battles.
You know what game this actually reminds me of?
Oh, mm-hmm. Go for it.
I mean this sort of genuinely.
Yeah.
But not fully. The original Paper Mario.
Okay. Yeah.
Because you have Mario, or Victor, in this case, who's basically like your combatant, and then your partner is present in battle and does things, but it is not targetable. Doesn't have a health bar.
Yeah.
So they changed that in the second Paper Mario. But that's all I meant, in that the combat sort of is like you have your one character and then your partner that does that you can change out at will, and there's only one of them out at a time, and that does different things depending on the situation. That's what it reminded me of, is Paper Mario. Thaumaturge is like Paper Mario.
There's a lot of like very like amusing characters that they did that, like, I grew attached to. Like I like Ligia, and I like Aburachi.
I just did that quest with, I can't pronounce the names. I should mention the English voice acting in this game is pretty good, and I don't know if these people are like native Polish speakers or what, but they're pretty good at pronouncing all these names that I cannot.
Yeah.
Aburachi, I just did the quest with him, and then that quest ends, at least the way I ended it, you both getting hammered. That was pretty fun.
Yeah, that was great.
the main character is also, there's some funny, like, sarcastic, he's kind of sarcastic, or he can be at times, some quips.
Yeah, depending on how you want him to respond to I think Victor becomes a really compelling protagonist over time, but just the way that, like, you're able to kind of have influence on his personality based on the way he responds to things. Like, a good job of calling that out. That, like, I also really like the English voice acting in this game as well. The cast is just does such like a great job capturing that time period. It's kind of a shame that they don't have like a Polish voice language.
They don't have it. Polish voices. That's sort of...
I believe they don't have Polish.
That's kind of weird. Like, I know, like, I've played, I think, Steel Rising, different game, but like a French game made by a French studio set in France didn't have French voices as an option. It's like, why not? I don't know.
I think it's definitely just like, I want to believe it's probably just a budget thing. Like, depending on, like, you know, the circumstances.
Yeah, I'm on the Steam page right now. It only has English. It supports Polish subs, but yeah.
There's this one moment early on where you're talking to people about, I think it's, you're talking to the gravedigger about your father's death, and they're wondering if it was like heart related, and your character kind of sarcastically, you don't have a great relationship with your father, says, well, we ruled out coronary causes since doctors couldn't confirm whether or not he had a heart, which, you know, just funny stuff, you know, like sarcastic jokes like that.
Yeah, it's very well, like, constructed dialogue of, like, how you would respond to such a situation if you didn't have, like, a great relationship with your dad, you know? It's, like, it doesn't feel stilted or mechanical or robotic. It's, like, it's very smartly done.
And I do think, playing this game through now, in your review, one of the things you criticized a fair bit was, like, just, like, performance. And it is sort of a janky game. Not necessarily in a good janky way, in terms of like a lot of texture pop in, sometimes just weird like visual effects I've seen here and there. There was one time where a loading screen, I got stuck on a loading screen for a while. That was kind of odd. But
I think I did have that too. Like, it was like once or twice that you mentioned it. It's hard to like kind of just a little bit behind the scenes, kind of gauge that, because when they sent that like review code for this game, there was like two builds we can choose from. It was one that was a stable build that was playable from start to end, but like it was like one that like they wouldn't continually update, because if you chose the other build that like would get continually updated, there's a chance of like they had to wipe save files due to like, you know, the changes they did. So I was like, okay, I don't want to lose my progress, so I just went with the safer option. So I don't know exactly what the final state, the technical state of the release build looks like, because I kind of went with the quote unquote safer build on that. So I don't know exactly like if they, you know, if the things that I experienced were eventually fixed or not on that end.
Yeah, I think they have one patch already, right? But it's one of those games that I'm sure over time, hopefully we'll get some of those kinks ironed out.
Yeah, and they're also, there's only available on PC now, but I think they're also planning to release this on PlayStation and Xbox.
This isn't really even here or there, but this is definitely the type of game I'm playing with keyboard mouse. It's feels like a PC RPG in that sense. Like, I don't know. Did you play with a controller?
No, I played on keyboard and mouse as well. Yeah,
it's that sort of game where it just feels like it fits that better.
So. Did you try it with a controller? I didn't try it at all.
Okay. No,
I have no idea. So, okay.
Definitely a CRPG type RPG.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You could
say like, does it does it support Steam Deck? That way you could try it portable and see how it works. That interface.
It actually does have a. I was going through the game graphics options, and there's a preset option for Steam Deck.
Steam
Deck. Yeah.
Cool.
So clearly they have some level of confidence in people playing with that interface. So
yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll try that.
It's kind of wild how like nowadays, especially for like more PC focused titles, like pretty much every game coming out has like some sort of care given. So it's like, yeah, it works on Steam Deck. It's like that's pretty damn cool.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, if you're interested in a different kind of RPG, definitely check this out. I really enjoyed my time in this game. It was a very nice surprise that just came out of nowhere for me. It was one of those games like, oh, that looks cool, but I don't know how it's going to shake out. But when I finally finished it from beginning to end, I was like, wow, this is a pretty awesome game.
Well, thank you, Josh and Adam, for talking about your time with Thaumaturge. And we do have Josh's review up on the site, rpgsite.net. So yeah, PC exclusive for now, but we'll obviously stay in touch if it comes out for consoles.
Never coming to PC.
No, before we get to that, I just wanted to like, Adam, are you planning to do like any guide or anything for this? When I was going to this game, I was like, no. I don't know how you guide this game.
It's so many interlocking things that like,
yeah,
you'd have to spend months like just trying to suss out all the different like permutations and options. And
I'll be like, very interested, like if the community for this game like eventually like gets like an Excel spreadsheet or like flow chart that like somehow maps out.
Here is how you do the optimal playthrough, like very step by step.
But based on the way you guys are describing it, you almost kind of, I won't say you won't want that, but more like you don't need that.
No,
you definitely don't need that. But I'd be interested, like just seeing like the trees, like looking back and like having finished the game, I'd be very interested to see like what the tree of this game looks like from that standpoint. Mm-hmm.
And then yeah, like Chow kind of teed up, the next game we're going to talk about is console exclusive to the Switch and the PlayStation and not on PC. And that is, of course, Unicorn Overlord. So this is a game that, of course, we had the demo release a few weeks ago, and we talked about it very briefly with the demo at that time. But of course, it's since full release. We don't have a written review for this game quite yet because it turns out it's quite lengthy. But I think that James and maybe Josh have played the release version of this.
I have not. Here was my plan. Okay, so at the morning of this recording, I just after almost 92 hours, I got FF7 Rebirth done, and I was like, cool, okay, I'm gonna get, like, my original plan was like getting this done before Unicorn Overlord came out, so I can go get on that. So I was like, okay, I'm not gonna make it, but you know, I'll hop on Unicorn after it. Then we got Rise of the Ronin code in, so now I can mention that I have that and now I can play it, but that's all I can say. So, you know, because of obligation, I have to delay my playthrough of Unicorn because I'm playing Rise of the Ronin now. So, and it is what it is.
In there. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah,
I had to stop on Grand Blue Fantasy Relink because of Rebirth.
Right.
Now that Rebirth's done, I'm like, well, now I kind of want to play. Maybe I'll wait for all the Relink post DLC to launch before I go back to it. But anyways, so who else has Chow? Have you been playing Unicorn?
No. Was it? I did have watched people play it, but I didn't touch it myself because
I touched a little bit of the demo, but that's it. Yeah,
I asked Colin last night if he wanted to hop on the podcast, but he wasn't able to, and he was like, "I'll wait until the review is up," because Colin is the one that's reviewing it for us. We did get an extra code though, and just to be blunt, it went to me just because I think besides Colin, I'm the only one on the staff that actually uses or owns an Xbox, and we got an Xbox code. So I'm about 35 hours into it. I forgot to say
Xbox. I said Switch and PS4, but yeah, it's also Xbox.
Yeah, there was an interview with Destructoid just like the other day, and it seems like if you were hoping for this game to come to PC, maybe stop hoping, because it doesn't seem like it's very likely at this point.
Yeah, the interviewer asked, like, hey, you know, a lot of the games have been coming to PC. Are there plans for Unicorn Overlord to come to PC at all? And the answer was like, from Atlus, like, per Atlus's agreement with Vanillaware, that's not happening, at least anytime soon, or if that's in the cards at all. But their agreement was it was only coming to consoles, not PC.
Yeah, and to be perfectly clear here, like, yes, there could be other reasons why it didn't come to PC, but I feel like it's a pretty safe assumption to say that if they okayed porting it to Xbox, but not PC, there's some reason at Vanillaware why they don't want it on PC.
I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for them, but you know, everyone, you know, always crosses their fingers and toes for a Vanillaware game to get an official release on PC.
Yeah,
it's just, yeah, I don't know.
You know, I don't know. Yeah. I have a friend whose theory has to do with, I don't know how. Well, their theory is that, when Atlus made, like, this negotiation with Vanillaware years and years and years ago, that was, like, even before they were part of Sega, really releasing on PC wasn't even, like, a consideration back then for Atlus. And his theory is that if they want to release on PC now, they probably have to, like, renegotiate whatever contractor agreement they have. But that might make things, like, that might adjust, you know, the balance of, you know, funds and money and things like that that they don't want to do.
That makes sense because Atlus has been publishing Vanillaware solely, at least in Japan, for many, many years now. And I imagine, like, part of the argument is, like, Atlus gives them a lot of time to make their games. Like,
yeah, like, it was going around, like, just yesterday, and you posted in the staff chat where it's like, yeah, they're, like, there was a Dem Famico article that went up. And on the article, they actually shared a character sheet from, like, in progress when they were just starting development for the game. And in the upper right corner, you can notice the date of when that character sheet was made. And it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, so it was dated March 7, 2014. The initial proposal for Unicorn Overlord, like, you know, was done behind the scenes. And it's like, this game has been development for, as of release, right now, literally a decade. Vanillaware takes their time when making games.
They can take as long as they want. That's for me. I love everything from them, you know?
Yeah. And thankfully, if nothing else, like, even if they, have run out of money yet again, developing this game, it does seem like, based off of the early sales, like, info we can glean from, like, Amazon and also, like, obviously the Japan side of things, that they're just fine. They're just fine.
Hopefully they're being successful. You know, like, I think by the nature of this game, it'll probably be more commercially successful than 13 Sentinels, just due to, like, the mass appeal of this game. Like, it's hard to sell 13 Sentinels to people who aren't really into that genre, but at least with Unicorn Overlord, it's like, this is a strategy RPG, tactical RPG, from our head.
RTS.
That's easy to, like, convey to people. But they're trying to describe 13 Sentinels to someone who doesn't know. It's like, okay, it's like an adventure game with like multiple characters, but you can kind of like do the order. And there's like a battle section that's like not as great as that, but just like, it's like, okay, you sound like an insane person already.
Speaking about the appeal of Unicorn is a little bit of a tangent. I do love like the social media, like Yatsumi Matsuno. Very eager and excited to play this, like just tweets getting the box, and people are like, you know, Square Enix should announce a new tactics, and he's like, dude, I'm just playing Unicorn Overlord. He's just like,
Unicorn Overlord. go pick up Unicorn Overlord. Yeah,
I feel like they're just like harassing to make a new game.
I think I've seen that with a few developers. This is a tangent of a tangent, so I'll keep it short. But like Josh Sawyer, whenever he tweets about anything he's playing or doing, people are like, we want a new Fallout New Vegas. He's like, you know what? I'm just going to play this other game. Like I'm just going
to
play this.
Wait. There's people that follow Josh Sawyer on Twitter for like to beg him for video games instead of his excellent tweets.
Yeah, basically. And I'm sure there's plenty of examples. And they're just like Matsuno here. It's just like, I'm just going to play Unicorn Overlord because it seems super neat. And if you are a fan of Final Fantasy Tactics, not the same sort of game exactly, but it has the same similar theming. So you should try it out.
Anyways,
it has lots of seal of approval, so you know it's the most powerful seal of approval.
Yeah. So to talk about the actual game itself, from rather than like everything surrounding it, like I said, I've got about like 35 hours into it. I'm guessing around like 60-70% of the way through the game. I would have been closer to the end, but like right when we got code in, I also was still trying to help a little bit with rebirth guides. I didn't do many of them, but I did like a couple, so it's like a day or two.
It's a team effort. Yeah it happens.
Where to start about this? So we did talk about the gameplay like a few weeks ago when the demo dropped. And so obviously nothing I can really say there that's explicitly different, but it's interesting how the game balance feels, because I am not really an RTS head. I'm not really a strategy RPG head. I would still say that if you've had any experience whatsoever in this genre, you should probably be playing this game on the hardest difficulty from the start, because if you're actually going out of your way to do everything on the map, which you should, because there is literally no like downside to doing so, the game gets really easy, really fast on anything below expert. Like really easy, really fast.
Everyone I watch are all playing on expert, so they never complain about any of the difficulty issues. But over here, we got Colin just like dreading. It's like, oh, this game's so easy. And I know Colin; he's not great at strategy games. And if he's saying it's easy, then it must be very easy.
Yeah. He was having no trouble whatsoever on tactical. Apparently, he's been having a bit more trouble on the fourth region. On tactical, but I don't know how I'll end up feeling that way.
I saw him tweet that he got to a new continent and had a little bit more challenge to it. Which at the time he was like, hell yeah, I want a little bit more challenge here. So no, that's good advice. I'm planning on starting on expert when I boot up.
It's kind of the nature of the beast. It's kind of an interesting like progression of the game, because this game is non-linear, and you can choose like pretty much the order you want to like kind of explore these regions, and being like a heavily tactical non-linear tactical game, you're kind of the difficulty fluctuation is kind of going to be inherently by the nature of the beast inconsistent, because you kind of chose your direction on where you want to go, and progression of this game is definitely dependent on like where you decide to explore first, what's your squad formation, how thoroughly did you explore the map for like kind of bolstering your equipment for your troops.
By the way, here's a tip for anyone playing the game, especially on expert. Keep mining until you get all five of the treasure maps for a region, because the stuff you get from digging up those treasure chests is really, really good. Like, you get a bunch of gold, you get like some sort of stat buff item, whether it's like for XP or for just like basic stats, and you always get a very, very good piece of equipment. So it's always worth doing it. And then also, like, if you're exploring, you're eventually going to find like the puzzle you need to solve for each region, where it's like, hey, here's these like plaques around the region, basically interact with these plaques in this order. And what you get from that, it's always worth it, because I believe it's a weapon that gives you +5 to every attribute you have, which is insane. Actually insane.
So you talk about a bit of the gameplay and how like the game is like, you know, battles, there's battle stages you participate in, and then just like usually there's been an objective like taking out an enemy commander to finish the battle stage. But in terms of like are there any characters that like kind of you've grown fond of throughout your journey, or any like troop types, like in general, like beyond the demo, like what can people expect out of this game?
So there is a large variety of troops you can find. I do know that, one thing I did say on Twitter when the embargo lifted is that this game's English dub is incredible. Like, oh my God.
A4 Games, did
localization was done by 8-4.
Okay.
8-4 has done tremendous localizations all across the board. And, they worked with Cup of Tea Productions for the voiceover. And that combination usually works out pretty well. For example, that's the combination that did both Nier games and the remaster for Nier 1.
Didn't Cup of Tea also do Saga Scarlet Grace? Because that game had a decent dub, yeah.
But I know for I won't claim to know exactly, you know, all the specifics about how this is typically done in the industry or whatnot. But I know 8-4 specifically, what they like to do is when they are doing voiceover, like there's a ton of different voiceover studios out there and they all have voice directors. But 8-4 will actually send one of the localization leads to the voiceover studio to basically sort of like co-direct the voices, because they're very intimate with the dialogue. They know like, okay, these lines were said with this context. We're like, here's how it should be said. You know, this is trying to give the actors as much information as possible in terms of describing, you know, what the mood should be or the character relationships or whatnot, to try to get the best voices possible. And so
that's an interesting process. I like that a lot.
And a lot of 8-4 people are like based in Japan. Right. So they actually have to travel to California oftentimes to do that. So that it's not just a hop and skip down the street to go to the voiceover studio. They actually like, all right, we're going to send someone across the ocean to the voiceover studio to help. Now, I can't claim that's what was done for this game. I don't know for sure, but I know they've done that in the past for the Nier games. So, but anyways, my whole point is that the 8-4 localization and the Cup of Tea voiceover is a pretty good combination.
It's always kind of frustrating when you have someone who you know is a good voice actor, but they have a line read and it's just clearly obvious they didn't know the context. Because, you know, like, it's not the person saying the line's fault at that point, but you're like, man, they just clearly didn't know what the context of this was being said. I think it's more and more rare, but it still pops up every time, every now and again.
Yeah, like sometimes you'll get lines, just an example, like, what are you doing here? But the emphasis should have been on you. Like, what are you doing here? And just stuff like that.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Where they just have the emphasis wrong because they didn't know. So, yeah. Rather than the place.
Sorry, James. We got sidetracked.
No, that's fine. I guess speaking of specific characters that I have been liking using, so there's a unit that you get in the second region that is so overpowered that like halfway through the region they take them away from you, and then you only get them back once you finish the region. That I'm not going to say who because it's a spoiler, but oh my God, they're like, they got this one skill where if they go first in the engagement, they basically glare at the enemy, and every other like every enemy unit like on the other side of the battle will lose initiative, and I believe also will have their crit rate or attack rate go like attack power go down, which if you combine that with a shaman or druid, which is the class that does a bunch of debuffs, it's like, okay, their initiative is down. That means that my druid's the upgrade version of shaman. So my druid will basically debuff them even more. And then that means that my main attackers in this unit are just basically like tearing through them like a hot knife through butter. And it's like, that's been overpowered really overpowered so far. Like, I posted a picture on Twitter where it's like, you, like, in the second region, like halfway through the second region, you unlock the Colosseum, which is basically like a one-on-one bout for like testing out your formations. And there's an NPC that joins you in the fight right before you unlock the Colosseum, who is just absolutely ridiculous. She's like level 40. And once you unlock the Colosseum, her thing is like, yeah, I don't really care about fighting for you guys. I just want to fight in the Colosseum. But if you can beat me and become the champion of the Colosseum, then I'll join you on your quest. So you'll be about like level 15, 16. Once you unlock the Colosseum, there's 30 fights. There's 30 fights in the Colosseum. She's the champion fight. And her the enemy level for the champion fight is level 40. So you're intended to not really engage with the Colosseum until the end of the game. My party's mid to low 20s. I am two fights away from challenging her.
Nice.
I should not be, but I found that one combination of units that just works out really, really.
I mean, that's
well.
Kind of the charm of the game, right? It's not like maybe you're not intended to be, but they gave you the systems to do it. It's not to say that you're cheating the game. It's like they gave you the this amount of options to do it. Like they really focus on like player freedom and expression, and just like give you the tools to suss it out yourself, you know?
Yeah. To be perfectly clear, though, like you also unlock like a bunch of first completion rewards for all the fights leading up to that. So even if I stopped right, like just short of getting her, I'm still going to snowball the rest of the game just because of the resources I've gotten from the Colosseum. Yeah.
So like, it's definitely that type of game where like it can be very imbalanced depending on like how you play the game. And I think it's like,
I feel like games like that shouldn't strive to be perfectly balanced, because that's kind of an impossible dream anyway.
As long as it's fun, I guess, for people, then it's fine.
Yeah, it's definitely fun. It's like just being able to be like, hey, I definitely shouldn't be managing this, but I am. So
it's like, thanks, game, for giving me the tools to like kind of intricately construct my squad and their gambits and their commands, you know, to kind of make it unfold the way that you want to. It's definitely a nice theory crafting game that, like, it's like on paper, does this do this? And it's like, and then you put it in action, it's like, holy shit, it does do that.
It's kind of a specific example. My favorite is Final Fantasy Tactics Advance, not the second one, just the first one. A sniper assassin, like sniper, gives bonuses to accuracy, which includes like the assassin instant kill attack. So you just be like, oh, I have a 95% chance of instantly killing anyone that I come up against. Then in the sequel, they're like, oh, it doesn't work that way anymore. I'm like, well, it was broken for the one game, and that's good enough for me.
It's kind of interesting because when we're talking about this game and like its initial proposal back in 2014, this decision to go non-linear, go explore however order you want to, that decision was made in 2021. Up until that point, it was designed to be a linear stage, a linear game that you just go through stage to stage to stage, and the map overworld map, which is like kind of this kind of almost window dressing to kind of give you, you know, some sort of progression in between stages. But they pretty much scrapped that whole scenario and just did it from scratch on like making it an open, like non-linear game in 2021, according to that interview that we were talking about earlier. And I was like, man, that's crazy, you know? To me, I'm so fascinated by this game's development now that like I've kind of got a better idea of like kind of how Unicorn Overlord came together. It's really fascinating, and I can't.
Well, I know
to
Vanillaware is like, obviously, if you ask people what are they known for, I think most people would immediately say the artwork, but also just the fact like they never made a game like 13 Sentinels, and then they did, and it was incredible. And maybe the jury's still out on Unicorn Overlord now, but like they never quite made a game like this. But then look at what they were able to put together, including maybe not last minute, but deep in a dev cycle, major changes like that, and they still were able to like they've got some chops over there. Like
I just hope
amazing studio.
I just hope they continue to live on and hopefully have a more healthy way of developing their games, instead of like, oh no, in our second project in a row, we ran out of money and we have to continue the project out of pocket now and finish development.
Yeah. It's like, we don't want to say, like,
please, you got to stop. Like, just game development shouldn't be, we just keep developing the game until we literally can't.
Fucking hell, dude. I love Middleware, and they're like one of those game developers. It's like, I will cry if they ever like announce that they shut down one day. So I'm just like, it's gonna be one of those days that's like, theoretically, if they announce they shut down, Kamitai is like, how could we have possibly avoided this? It's like, ah, god damn it. But I'm really interested to see like what more folks day of the fall, you know, the full game. It's a nice hearing, you know, like seeing what crazy strategies you're coming up with, James. And I can't wait to just, you know, when I get around to when games stop coming, you know, and I get a chance to like sit down and
May, because May seems like the only respite in the entire fucking year at this point.
If I'm lucky, okay, here we go again with a plan, and that will totally work out. If I'm lucky, I'll get Rise of the Ronin done and get the review written up, and then, you know, it'll go up whenever. But then after that, I can maybe get around to this game before Dragon's Dogma 2 comes out. I'm optimistic. I gotta be confident in this plan. And yeah. And how about you, Chao? How are you gonna get around the Unicorn Overlord with what you've got on your plate?
I don't think I can, but I think I'm gonna do the bare minimum playthrough. I heard this game is so free, you can like even go straight to the last boss like pretty early or something. That's what I heard from.
Yes,
something.
I heard it's like Breath of the Wild-ish in that respect.
You're not going to beat the final boss because it's like level 40 and.
Oh, they found ways. People that are tactical expert found ways.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, like, so. I don't know. I watched some video on like in-depth analysis. Like, this game is like full of like some very like surprises. Like, there's one part where this guy lost, and his characters were forced into the forest, and like wondering why the enemy's not chasing him in the forest. It's like, oh, when you're in the forest, you have like a stealth. It's like a fog of war to them, so they can't detect you if you're in the forest. And then it opens all like this depth of strategy on them, you know. But I just see like there's like so much freedom in this game, which could be a good or a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a game for like brain, like if you have brain worms on like theory crafting games, this might be a game for you, because this is a game that's like, it has so much depth to it that you can explore. I can't even imagine, like, I think this will be a game that's like, it won't be fully dissected for months. the on how certain mechanics work in this game, because there's so many like class variety types too. And then on top of that, you can recruit like generics of class types as well. So you kind of have a lot of like theoretical formations at your disposal on like what will work well together. You know, there's like almost, obviously this would be hyperbole, but it feels like there's like a million different ways to like solve problems in this game. And it's up to you kind of to figure out what you're comfortable with on that end. It's gorgeous. I can't wait to play it. Fuck.
Did you have any other like final thoughts on your time so far with Unicorn Overlord, James?
Nothing else I really want. I kind of want to save a little bit of discussion for when Colin's here, hopefully next week. But I've been enjoying it quite a bit. I'm excited to play more, and hopefully I can finish this before certain other games come in. Because
I was gonna say like the schedule doesn't get easier, but maybe this is a game that once we have more of us on the cast, or we got Colin on, or a combination of that, we could revisit in a podcast in a few weeks or a month. Once we have people who have seen the credits, we have multiple people that can bounce ideas off of, it might be a real fun one to revisit at that point. But yeah, really cool first impressions, both from your time with the release and everyone else's time with the demo. Definitely one that I think pretty much everyone here is eager to set aside time for and get to at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later. With that, I think we'll go into article shoutouts in the news, because I don't think we had any other game clearly listed up front here to talk about. I know a lot of us are still playing through Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. I will shout out a feature that Alex Donaldson, who has been mulling over the Rebirth story and ending ever since the game came out, was able to put a lot of his thoughts together and put them into an article on the site, basically dissecting the ending. Of course, that article is entirely spoilers, so I won't discuss anything else here on this recording. But if you've played through and finished Rebirth and you're curious about just reading all different opinions and thoughts and interpretations of the ending, Alex was able to put one up for our site, up on RPGsite.net, very clearly marked with spoiler warnings and all that. So that's up on the site. Like don't I said, forget, James, we also have... Too. Say that again?
Don't forget, James helped out in that article as well.
Oh, obviously. Yeah. A few people kind of bounced ideas, Josh, too, and a few others. Because Alex was just like, this is how I interpreted it. Am I way off? Or is this kind of what other people thought, too? So a few other people kind of had some ideas about them when that went up.
Not to toot our own horn, but it definitely feels like we got the most comprehensive analysis of this. There's been some people that have been talking about the ending where it's like, you definitely missed at least a few things.
Yeah, I need to go read that up now that I've seen the ending, and there's definitely some things I caught on and some things I didn't. So I'm gonna hold myself back, but like there's a show in my head that like, oh, this ending makes sense because I've seen this specific show before, but I don't want to mention it because obviously that would kind of
spoiler by proxy in your hand.
Yeah, exactly. But it made me laugh that when I made that connection of it. One of my friends is like, I never thought of it, but now, god damn it.
Because I'm curious, put that in the voice channel text. I kind of want to know.
Okay, sure. I'll just mention the show on the voice channel.
And then the other major feature that I want to shout out is that, of course, one of the upcoming games we've already mentioned a couple times is Dragon's Dogma 2. On the news front, Capcom did release basically the character creator, where you can kind of preemptively create both your Arisen and your pawn ahead of the game. I have not messed with this too much, but I've seen plenty of people like sharing, I don't know if it's a code or like a template, but like people trying to create different, you know, fictional characters within the character creator and sharing those around ahead of the game. And then we also do have a preview feature. I believe Alex was on this as well. Yeah, about his excitement for Dragon's Dogma. And I know previews, some people love them, some people hate them. But we do have a preview for Dragon's Dogma for those that are trying to gobble up any pre-release information for that game ahead of its full release later in the month. We have that up on the site as well, on rpgsite.net. With that, I think we're ready to head on into the main news of the week, and lots of kind of heavy hitters here, as well as a few smaller surprises. This first one, I don't know if it's a surprise or a heavy hitter. Maybe it's a little bit of both, and it's something that maybe we expected, but not as soon as we got it. And that is that Atlus has officially announced the release of Persona 3 Reload Episode Aegis, which adds the Answer Story expansion to Persona 3 Reload in September.
No.
So how do we feel about this?
Hey, Chow, guess what? They can change it and make it good this time.
I hope so, because I don't like the gameplay of the original, but I'm okay with the storyline. I actually do like the storyline.
I do think it's a story premise that isn't often touched on, so
it's like nobody likes to talk about the aftermath of the instance, you know, and how to deal with grief.
Right.
I think the word grief is a bit too much of a spoiler, though.
Well, I think Persona 3 is a little older now. People should be aware. So this is coming out later this year. This is sort of an awkward announcement, just talking about like nuts and bolts of the announcement here. So this is the announcement of an expansion pass for Persona 3 Reload, which Atlus pricing, if you got the digital deluxe edition of Persona 3 Reload when it released last month, you didn't get the expansion pass with that. That's separate. Like, okay.
Oh, wow. I thought that came with it. Holy shit. that's weird. Okay,
now let me double check that. I'm pretty sure it's separate because it...
I've seen people mention that. So unless people that I've read have been wrong, that's exactly
which,
what I've read.
So, which in a way, like since the expansion pass wasn't even known to be a thing when they couldn't advertise it with a digital deluxe because it didn't exist yet. So it's like, yeah, if you got the $100 edition of Persona 3 Reload, do you get the expansion pass with it? I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No, because it's a separate expansion pass from the already existing like season pass, from what I understand.
Yeah, that season pass, yeah.
Some extreme milking right there.
Oh, man.
Also, the expansion pass itself, it comes with more than just the episode, I guess. It also comes with the Persona 5 Royal BGM set and the Persona 4 Golden BGM set, as well as the Velvet Costume and BGM set. It's just like...
It definitely seems like it's a type of situation where it's like everything besides episode, I guess,
it's just kind of basically fluffy stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like, obviously there was some amount of like budget that went into it, but in comparison, it was basically free for Atlas to do. But if they put it in the expansion pass and make it so that you need the whole pass in order to get the stuff that you actually want, it's like, okay, on its own, maybe it would have to be 25 or 30. But now that we have the summer stuff, we bump up the price of it. So it's like, okay, now we can charge 35.
Okay, so the price point for this expansion pass that you got, or say, is 35. Now, have they mentioned at all if episode Aegis will be sold separately or no?
I don't believe so. I don't believe you can buy it separately.
I'll be interested to see, like, when it hits, if they'll sell it separately or not. Because, like, I'm definitely not buying this until, like, this comes out and then we know, like, solidly for sure, concretely.
There's no fucking way I'm touching this yet. One thing that is worth mentioning, which, if you have been playing this game through Game Pass and you have Game Pass Ultimate, you get the expansion pass for free.
Yeah.
It's going to be a perk when it launches through Game Pass Perks. And the interesting thing about that is since it's a perk, once you redeem it, even if you let your Game Pass lapse, you'll still have access to the DLC. So you could just like buy the base game when it's inevitably on sale for like $20 or something.
Okay, yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of weird. But yeah, but so far, you know, the main thing is with this is, hey, you get to see Metis in the remake with her a new model. And the Abyss of Time dungeon is sort of like Tartarus, where like it seems like it's sort of like Tartarus, or like you get more detailed environments as you're going through the dungeon. We don't know anything else outside of that, like if there's any core changes. You still have Aegis as the main protagonist, obviously, and you're still in this time loop story. But other than that, we don't know. And they're going to have new Thurgies attacks, which is a new mechanic in the remake. But other than that, we don't know if they're changing anything else. Because, you know, a lot of the quirks people had with this story, with this post-game story, was it's definitely more combat oriented focused, because of, like, the narrative elements were kind of poorly paced in the sense that like there was barely any of it as you're kind of going through it. So yeah, we'll see. I don't know, it's kind of interesting, maybe.
As someone that's on the outside, and I have Persona 3 Reload like installed on my Steam Deck to eventually get to when I can freeze time. First of all, the announcement of this, even though I understand it's a post game, so I watched Adam play this when we were younger on the PS2. I know it's a post game thing, so the announcement of this doesn't really give me any substantiation to wait, but still, it's kind of my natural inclination. It's like, oh, I'll just wait. I can't play this until September. But also, like, when the Reload was announced, it just seems like, I don't know if scummy is too strong a word, but it's just fishy that it's like, oh, this doesn't have FES content, it doesn't have portable content, and then like a little bit over a month after releases, oh yeah, we were working on FES content, here it is.
Yeah, because the interviews were definitely like, they couldn't hint at it at all, and they were like, yeah, we're just working on like the original like Persona 3 content for now. Like,
No. The developer says like, oh, we made this thanks to fan feedback. It's like, there's no way, because it's like, this.
Oh yeah, there's follow like producer message saying that like, oh yeah, this is only possible because of fan feedback. It's like, you know, because of how game development works, we know part of that is clearly a lie. You know, there's no way you just kind of like, oh, the fans are asking for it, let's do it. You know, that's, yeah. Come on.
And of course, there's been, I forget the exact publication, but of course that naturally led to like, well, does that mean FMC is on the table, FMMC? And they're like, no, that's definitely not on the table. It's like, I don't know.
To play devil's advocate for a moment, it's entirely possible that when Persona 3 Reload got revealed and then people started asking about the answer and they said it wasn't going to be in it, then they might have started development then when they realized just how like big the
I don't think they started development on it like from scratch there. I think they already had plans to maybe do it, like maybe had like a
potential, but the point is to it,
but I don't the think point, they started yeah, development the, because of the, that.
Yeah, the point is though is that it's entirely possible that that it got greenlit for an actual like a DLC after they saw the reactions pre-release. That's entirely possible. And the reason I believe that might be the case is because of what they were saying about FMC and saying, look, we know people wanted this, but we just couldn't justify it because, and I know I completely understand people upset about that. Like obviously the fact that Persona has not had a female protagonist since then sucks. And obviously there should be like Atlas themselves should be better about, God, I don't even know the best way of putting this, but basically I understand why people are upset and people have actually data mined the game and seen that at least at one point they very obviously were considering it and seeing.
Oh, that's new to me. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Cause people found they found data for like characters from the FMC route and P3P that obviously aren't in Reload now, but the only reason they would have been in is if they were trying to adapt some of the FMC stuff and they ended up not doing so.
In general, like I saw some people going back to, I think it was an old interview from Waypoint, I'm not sure, where they were talking about Persona protagonists. And I think that the protagonist in question at the time was 4. And they're like, of course, how come there's no female protagonist option here? Like, well, because of our story, we have a person moving from a big town to a small town, and we think a male protagonist fits that role better. And you're like, quit.
Yeah, you say so.
Women not move?
You see, the funny thing about that is that Persona 4 is like the only one where there's like a legitimate argument for, oh, no, this has to be a dude, considering the whole Izanagi, Izanami thing. But of course, they're not going to say that because it's like kind of technically a spoiler. But yeah,
it's just this just feels weird because it was announced. When did Persona 3 Reload release?
It released
February 2nd. So
yeah,
and this announcement came out just a month after that, and then it's coming later this year. It's kind of like it's not a 1-to-1 scenario, but it's like when Marvel vs. Capcom 3 first came out, and then later that year Ultimate Marvel vs. Capcom 3 came out. You know, and it's like, okay, thanks, I guess. It's not a brand new game that's coming out, but it's like they're reselling content that already came out before, and they're now doing it as the end of like this expansion pass, and it's just like we don't have to wait for Persona 3 Reload Fest and paying $70 again, I guess, for it, which is.
Oh, in Japan, that was hilarious. You had to pay the $70, and there's the App Hand edition. If you don't have the save data from the original, they won't even let you play the game.
I obviously saw the announcement of this earlier in the week because a lot of the response was kind of excited, but also kind of a little bit exasperated. Like, oh, there it is. We all knew it was coming for multiple reasons. Like there was like the leaks and the teases for that, but also be like, of course they were going to do something like this. It just seems like a very Atlas thing to do, but I didn't realize until just now that it wasn't coming till September. I assumed it was like an April, May thing. Like, oh, it's not till September. Oh, okay. I guess I'll check back in half a year.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, either way, what we say doesn't matter because they keep on doing it because people buy into it and it will never stop.
Yep. Yeah. Exactly. Yep. Right.
At the end of the day, it makes the money, it's consistent, people will buy it without question, and they'll keep on doing it.
The next major announcement from this week, based on a teaser trailer and the opening of a new official website from Falcom, is the announcement of a new project in the Tokyo Xanadu series, potentially slated for 2025. Though, Adam, I do believe you had a small caveat on that based on...
Basically, I first said it was announced for 2025, and it's like, well, 2025 is the 10th anniversary of Tokyo Xanadu, and they specifically mentioned that, and it's very likely that this game is targeting 2025, but they never outright directly specifically say this game is coming out in 2025, even though I think that would very likely be the hope and the plan. But basically, the specific detail is that this is a new Tokyo Xanadu game made for the 10th anniversary of Tokyo Xanadu, which would be 2025, coming out in the future, in which 2025 is also in the future, but who knows when it's actually releasing. But yeah, there's not very many details on this game yet, other than...
Finally, Kyoto Xanadu.
Yeah, this actually confused me for a bit. I guess I don't remember if this was detailed in the original game, if it's like alternate where Kyoto is the capital of Japan in this universe. Because they say Japan's capital city, Kyoto, and that confused me for a bit. I'm like, wait a minute, what does that mean? they also, they say it's going to have new setting, and they also say it's basically like new mechanics and systems. So whatever that means.
I will say that I wasn't the biggest fan of Tokyo Xanadu when I played it, but I feel like a lot of that comes down to the fact that it felt too derivative of Cold Steel. And not just that, like, I feel like just so much of Tokyo Xanadu is just like, hey, remember this from X Falcom game? Like, the EX Plus stuff is literally just, hey, what if we did Trolls in the Sky the Third again?
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what it is. which is very funny. I thought the gameplay for Tokyo Xanadu was fine.
Music and
I
think is incredible.
I do think there is potential for a follow-up if they actually, like, build upon it and they try different things. But it's... So I'll play this, but also it's like... It's got to be more original.
They need to really wrap it
like,
up with this.
For God's sake, they even reused the fucking Gnosis plot point from Trails from Zero in fucking Tokyo Xanadu for one of the chapters. It's like, guys, you can't just steal plot points from your other games and just insert them in this one game. That doesn't... No! Stop.
As someone who's a little bit more on the fringe, so obviously I've played the localized versions of most of the East and Trail series. Team me up, James, and or Adam, or I guess any of you here are probably more educated than I am. This was originally a PSP game. They got an EX version that was
Vita,
and then PlayStation 4. Is it just a single game with its expanded version, or was there two?
A single game with expanded version. EX Plus, though, was a pretty radical like improvement from the original. Like, you had a bunch of, like, in between chapters, you had these little vignettes, chapters to focus more on the side characters, which was good in theory, but the problem was is that a lot of the character development in those vignettes, since it wasn't in the original game, just gets ignored, which is funny. And then there was the EX Plus, like, actual, like, epilogue that was, like, 10, 15 hours, something like that.
Yeah, the ending stuff is kind of funny. I don't remember all the details, but I remember like the original ending of the game is sort of a bittersweet ending. And then you do the post game of the original, and it's like, okay, everything's happy, everything's perfect, no more bittersweet ending. And then you do the EX Plus ending, and it's like, okay, things are still happy, but there are issues that we need to deal with potentially down the road.
The problem was is that the original normal ending for Tokyo Xanadu actually was really good. It actually had some character development for Ko, and it set up the idea that he could continue on into another game. The true ending basically completely ignored that. It was like, okay, fuck character development. We're going to give you your happy ending anyways.
That's what I meant.
But EX Plus... It's like, okay, you got your happy ending, but there is a consequence for that. Here's the first taste of the consequence, but this isn't over. So EX Plus wasn't even more of a happy ending. It was a course correction so that they could continue on as a series because they realized, wait a second, this sold really well. We probably should make it so that the canon ending for this game has room to grow. Because with the original, the true ending basically was like, okay, there is never going to be any issues whatsoever.
Which now was, it seems like this new game has a new cast because it's set in a new place and none of the characters look familiar. The only character that it seems common so far, and I'm sure there'll be cameos or whatever, is they have a quote from Rem. I don't remember exactly what Rem was, but she's sort of like this spirit goddess girl.
Ghost.
I don't remember. Like, sorry. I don't remember exactly either. What she
the
was.
Only thing I keep remember, I almost like getting her mixed up with Kia from like Trails of Asher. I keep thinking like find me or something. I don't know.
But she, like, do you remember what Rem said? Like, okay, so she's there. But
of course I don't remember what Rem said. I beat this game almost like 10 years ago.
Yeah, like, oh, whatever.
Well, I'll beat it again and then Rem's dead.
It's like, no way. I get like emails all the time. Like, when are you gonna finish? It's like, when are you gonna finish this guide? I'm like, okay. I don't know anymore.
Okay, we have two important questions that needs to get answered about when you see more of this game. One, are they bringing back the idle unit Spica for this game? And two, is Towa going to show up?
So you know they'll show up if, what is that guy, if Singa's composing the music.
Well, I mean,
Toa's cameo in this game, she's treated like a different character that is
having the
same look. She's the exact same character right? Who is different.
She's not a teacher. She's a teacher.
She's your college. She's a teacher. Yeah, no, she is a teacher in Tokyo Xanadu, and there's even an implication that she is a universe hopper because there is a situation in a side quest where it's like, hey, this reminds me of something, and it's a direct reference to something from Cold Steel. It's like, why does this seem familiar? It's like,
okay. Well, that might just be, I don't know, not having played the game, that could just be like a fan service-y tease rather than something canon. It's tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Seriously, though, ideally, they just like kind of build from the ground up again and like kind of scrap everything the first thing did and just do it as this own original thing.
The combat was fine. You can build upon the combat and probably right, be...
No, the combat is fine.
Is it still turn-based like Cold Steel? Or
oh, no. It's action. It's like Zwei 2. Kinda.
Brian's like, what does that mean?
No, I've seen
it. I would say the combat is only fine in the X version. The original version is not fine. It was too easy. Everything feel like an HP sponge. And yeah, it's not worth touching.
I mean, as presumably this will be on their like current new engine too, so hopefully, yeah. You know, it looks great. I guess this is really weird news. Okay.
We have other couple announcements for this week. This one is one that I'm actually sort of interested in, and that is the announcement from 9Dot Studio of an Outward 2. So Outward is actually a game that I played back when it released, I think like right before the pandemic, like 2019 era. And 9Dots is like at the time was like an indie Canadian studio. I think they had like 10 people. I think they've grown quite a bit since then. But Outward 1 was basically kind of like a hybrid Western RPG / survival game that was explicitly designed as a two-player game with like drop-in, drop-out co-op. With some combat that was kind of vaguely Souls-like in terms of very deliberate, slow action combat from behind the shoulder view with a stamina health duality, which I know is kind of a generic way to describe a lot of games, but that was kind of my impression of it at the time. So yeah, Outward 2 has a trailer that they're talking about having a pre-alpha, and there's no set... they're saying that this is coming out for PC without specifying consoles or a date yet. But I had a good enough time with Outward 1 that I'm kind of excited for an Outward 2, just like a little AA, ambitious Western RPG with a really open-ended style to it. I actually was planning on playing Outward 1 with Adam at some point, but I think we just got too busy to actually play through it. But yeah, I'm excited about this, and I'm glad that the studio did well enough with the first game to end up following up on it, because this could be something pretty special.
That first game sold over a million copies, right?
I think I remember they actually got to
1.3 million.
Yeah, so you know, hopefully.
One thing about Outward 1 that was actually kind of neat is that it opens up that basically you have a it's been, I know it's only been like 4 or 5 years, but my memory is still a little bit foggy. You open up and you're, for some reason, I think it's for a medical bill, you're in debt to the town that you wake up in. So you're given literally like a time limit that says like you have 60 days in-game days to repay your debt. And it doesn't tell you how to do it. It's very open-ended. Like you could just sell a bunch of materials. You could do quests and try to get some rewards. And it's there's just a little bit of stress, because whenever there's a time limit, there's a little bit of stress, but in a way that actually felt like meaningful. Like you actually, you couldn't just slack. You had to be like, I have a debt to pay. I have to do this. And then there were, like, at the time, the game ended up having some post-game additions that I never really played. But at the time, it had basically three major story routes that took you to, like, different parts of the world. The two that I most clearly remember is that there was one that takes you to, like, a desert kingdom. And there's one that takes you to, like, a poison swamp area. And the thing is that the routes were felt very, very different. Like, all the regions were, like, very clearly separated from each other. And there was either no or very limited fast travel. So, like, if you wanted to do a quest that took place in the desert, you had to pack whatever survival... It's a part survival game, so there were, like, temperature meters and hunger and thirst and things like that. So if you wanted to prepare for your trip to the desert, you had to be like, do I have enough provisions? Do I have enough, like, food and rations and water? And do I have the right gear for it? Like, it actually had some of that, like, sort of stuff where it's, like, time to make a trek. Like, today, me and I was playing with a friend that I play with... Guild Wars on, like, do we think we can make this without dying? Like, that had that sort of feel to it, with a lot of games kind of like sand away the edges, or it's like, oh yeah, you can make it, and then once you make it there, you can fast travel back. It's like, they might have tweaked it since launch, but at the time there really was no option. Like, once you make it there, it's like, all right, we made our trip and now we're here, and now we're going to be here for a bit, because we're not ready to make a trip back. So that was the thing that I really liked about Outward 1, and I really hope they kind of keep that same look and feel for Outward 2. So yeah, like I said, no date. We just got a pre-alpha trailer for it, and we'll keep our eye on it as more details come out over the course of the year. And this was one thing that Adam tried to team me up on that I wasn't really expecting, is that I don't know if this was in the exact same announcement or if it just coincided with this week, but Nine Dots announced that they were going to be opening a publishing branch called Nine Dots Publishing. And then in addition to announcing that they were working on Outward 2, they've also announced that they are publishing another title called Witherbloom, being developed by a small developer called Evercurious. So not only is Nine Dots working on their own sequel, but they are publishing this Witherbloom from Evercurious, also not with a specific release date, with a pre-alpha footage, kind of very early trailer for it. So I don't know, just really cool to see that it seems like they've got a lot of work ahead of them over in Canada, and a lot of interesting projects on the horizon from kind of like these indie Western developers.
Yeah, this just reminds me of the 11-bit studios who published the Thaumaturge, that they had like a really, really big presence in the recent Xbox preview partner showcase that streamed. They had like a ton of games. They showed like Frostpunk 2, The Alters, Creatures of Ava, I believe, were the three that they showed. It's like, wow, they're really bringing it this year.
Mm-hmm. We also got the announcement of a kind of another creature fantasy adventure RPG called Home of the Yokai. James, you're the one that covered the news bit for this. Like, I see the trailer and I see the screenshots here for it, but I didn't actually dig into the press release to see exactly what sort of game this was.
So this is a new independent studio based out of China. They're making a creature capturing RPG, but it also seems like a bit of an RTS. Funnily enough, a good comparison would be Unicorn Overlord, because if you look at that one screenshot, you set up formations of your creatures and then they auto battle. So like originally I actually titled it as like, this is like, like an SRPG or an RTS, because it's like, yeah, it's an RPG, but it's like very clearly the way battles work is more akin to something like that. But yeah, it looks really neat. I love the art style they're going for. You can see it in like both the screenshots and the trailer, and it's like they don't have a release date. They said coming pretty soon, so maybe that'll be this year. I kind of hope it isn't. This year's too stacked already, but yeah, I'd be interested in checking it out. It looks like a fun time.
It's got a really charming art style. Just like the box art from Steam as well. It's just very apparent and evident in the screenshots and in the trailer for it.
Yeah, and I checked, and already they've got like 10,000 wish lists on Steam, which seems to be pretty good.
Wow.
And I'll say it. Like, I think that they're doing everything right to get people interested just with like the art, and like they definitely like hit the ground running with like here's everything we have to show. It's like, yeah, this will probably be an interesting time.
And again, that's called Home of the Yokai by Raka Studios. The next announcement is that NIS America have announced that they're bringing RPG Maker with over to the West for Switch, PlayStation 4, and PlayStation 5 this fall. So this was, I guess the Japanese publisher is Gacha Gacha Games, and they've announced that the Japanese version of the newest RPG Maker will be coming out in April. And then NIS America have released their own announcement trailer saying that they're bringing the worldwide version of it over this fall.
You can actually like upload like your unfinished projects and like get like feedback on it from other people online saying like, hey, you know, but what do you think? And kind of give like feedback online, like kind of assisting with game development. It's like more of like cooperative sort of endeavor. It's interesting like a concept you're going for with this one.
This next announcement, I think, took most of us by surprise. This is a game that was kind of like an underdog story a few years back, and that is Sakuna of Rice and Ruin. This ended up being one of the top 10 games of the year in the year that it released. And I remember it was almost like a cheerleading effort watching this game slowly climb its way to a million from a tiny little... Is it was it like a three-person studio or something really tiny?
Edelweiss was like a very, they were like a small indie studio because they were releasing their games at Comiket. It's like,
yeah, I think they only had like really like three or four main like developers. And I'm sure they've had like additional, you know, contracted for art or some, a few other music or maybe, but yeah, very, very small.
Yeah. Also, I don't know. I don't know if this is in the article itself, but just a quick update. It's not just an anime that was announced. They also announced that this has shipped over 1.5 million copies.
Yeah, so I buried the lead a little bit there. It's my bad on that. But yeah, the main announcement here is the announcement of a Sakuna of Rice and Ruin anime project that will air this year, so not too far off. And they've got even like the full Seiyu cast already listed and detailed as well. And then, yeah, I wasn't aware that the 1.5 million shipments in digital sales. So clearly a huge success story for Sakuna of Rice and Ruin, which I know, Adam, you thought pretty strongly of this game, and everyone I think who's played it has really, really thought that it was a charming, really interesting, kind of inventive game that doesn't really compare well to anything else
because it feels quite like this, it. So this game is interesting because the Japanese government just like actually like considered it like culturally like relevant to the Japanese people. Like,
it's exploded in popularity in Japan. Like several months out of the time release, like they were even getting like interviews from farming magazines or newspapers in Japan.
Yeah, the Ministry of Agriculture or something basically gave them like some sort of like accolades because it's like, holy shit, your game actually got people interested in growing rice.
So it's just what a tremendous achievement from Edelweiss, dude. The animations from PA Works, one of the best in the business, and it's just, I'm excited to see this like unfold. Like, I will definitely watch this show. This is like a really fascinating. Like, even at the time when we were talking about it, it's like this game was like one of like XSEED's best sellers in the West, I believe.
it was so successful in both like the West and in Japan that it just straight up kickstarted like Marvelous Japan's whole thing, where it's like, hey, here's our indie publishing brand. Because we got so much success from Sakuna that it's like, we need to try and get as many of these as we can.
Yeah, so what a... Good on Edelweiss, dude. They produced something incredible, and like, we'll have a legacy.
The funny thing is that they already were a fairly established, like, indie developer, at least for, like, the more... For folks that were familiar with that side of the industry. Like they did Astabreed, which was a really great shmup. So
So I
think I got to the last level in that game. Didn't really beat it though. I got on the PS3 because it was like $5. Like, wow, this is a bargain.
I don't think Astabreed ever released on PS3. I thought it was only PS4 and PC.
Something, or I'm thinking of the wrong game then.
But yeah, either way though, this will be airing sometime this year also. This will be at, they're going to show off more of it at the Anime Japan, which will be coming up soon. Like end of March, I believe. And yeah, that's great. You know, I can't wait to see more. I can't wait to watch the show and see how they adapt it. I can't imagine how many episodes was be dedicated to like farming.
Yeah, I did play Astabreed. Okay, it was on the PS4 then. Maybe I got mixed up then.
Yeah. I remember buying, like playing like Astabreed on PC, enjoying the hell out of it. Then the PS4 version got announced and said, they were like, here's a bunch of content exclusive to PS4. Radio silence on whether or not that content was going to come to PC. So I bought the limited run games physical copy of the game for PS4 specifically to get that content. Didn't get around to playing it because I, like, obviously I had other stuff to play. And then by the time I was going to start playing it on PS4, it's like, hey, here's all the PS4 content on PC. It's like, why?
They got you.
But yeah, just really cool to kind of cheer them on from the sidelines. That, you know, that now that they've got an animated project and everything about Sakuna Rising Ruin was probably a big gamble for that handful of people, and it's just been a huge success for them.
Mm-hmm.
I love that I can say that I liked Edelweiss before they were cool.
Bunch of hipsters here on the TetraCast.
No, I didn't they do the Fairy Bloom Freesia game, or was that another studio? That was them then. I was there.
Let me check.
They developed Edelweiss. I fucking love that game.
The hipster among hipsters.
Yep, that's right. So, there you go.
All right, Chow, you stayed up late last night watching Granblue News.
And I did.
We already knew that Granblue Fantasy Relink was going to get a 1.1 version later in the month, or a week from now on the 14th, with the new endgame boss. We kind of talked about that either last week or the week before. But they detailed some more information about the 1.1 update, or at least about a future update with, I don't know how to pronounce this guy's name,
Sandalphon.
All right, so what did you, in the middle of the night last night, where we were all, you know, cozily tucked in bed and you were up watching video game streams?
I was watching, like, other, like, Twitch streamers trying to watch this. They come from the Honkai community trying to watch it, and they're like, I play Granblue Relink. I'm going to stay up. I was like, no, you're not going to stay up. You'll literally have to wait till, like, 4 a.m. if you watch freaking Relink news. And I think they are really, like, passed out before they even start airing.
Yeah, if you don't know what you're getting,
but you made it.
I made it.
He's a seasoned veteran. He's been around the business already.
Okay, we're doing a new Lucilius raid, which is in the mobile game, and we're like, okay, we need that free stuff. It'll make this content a little bit easier, and we'll take anything right now. So we'll stay out trying to wait for news. That's
okay,
how it goes.
So let's focus on the Relink stuff, on what they showed off here. What are the details on the Relink stuff?
Okay, so the next one's version 1.1. So that will include the Lucilius raid called the Final Vision. They show like a 1 minute trailer of fighting him, and then there's a guest character that will fight with you, which is Sandalphon. So I guess, like, since they made the assets for him already, it's like, well, he's the next playable character that will come out in May. So Sandalphon's the most popular Granblue character of all time. I don't really care for him all that much, but, you know, a good, let's just say, you know, like the half of the audience is girls, and she's every girl's favorite character. They'll simp for him. I have another crew that literally wasted $2,000 trying to get two of his weapons. Like, they love this man. They'll go broke for this dude. Backstory behind this guy is, like, he's kind of like a douchebag that starts out because he was sealed in this crystal for a long time, and then he somehow broke out, and then he wants to get revenge on the world. But later on, he finds out that he was wrong, and everybody did it to protect him, and then he has, like, this awesome redemption story where he's trying to fix everything that he did wrong, and now he's, like, the most popular character ever. And I think that the side games didn't even know he would become that popular, so that the most popular event is called What Makes the World what makes the sky blue? And they kind of rewrote the story of the, like, the later parts of Tater to him as being the protagonist of that story. And now he's the most popular character in Granblue of all time.
Okay, so the like you mentioned, we only see him as a cameo in this version 1.1. Then it'll come later in May at version 1.3. Then they also showed off some gameplay for Seofon and Trien, or is it Siete and Song, in most commonly referred to. And those are the version 1.2 characters coming in April, and then they showed off some gameplay for them in the stream.
I'm kind of hyped for Song. It's like she plays a lot different than I expect.
Yeah, she's very mobile. Yeah, I saw. Like, yeah, she seems like a very mobile archer.
Like, she flies a lot in the mobile game, but here it's like, oh yeah, she gets all these like cool spread shots, and you're like, you're thinking like archer. They don't have like all these spread shots kind of thing, right? And they even like tease like her main mechanic is that she paralyzes. In the mobile game, getting Song is that she can paralyze targets. So back then, like, these fights are next to impossible, and you would bring her to fight Bahamut, and you land her skill, the boss becomes paralyzed for 2 minutes in a turn-based game. And so people are, like, trying to speed run, trying to kill this boss before the paralyze runs out so they can kill Bahamut. That's kind of like her main gimmick in the mobile game, right? But, you know, paralyze is too powerful because that will trivialize all game mechanics, so she kind of became useless in the mobile game because paralyze is too strong, so we'll make everything immune to it. So she's kind of useless in the current state of the meta, right?
So have you seen that final vision trailer for
Lucilius? I did. It looks crazy. It looks
What can you glean from that? And does it accurately reflect what his mobile or browser game?
It kind of does too, because right now in a browser game you're fighting the new version. He basically has two swords. There's a yellow sword and there's like a red sword. I forgot what their exact name is called, but you could see in the trailer where he basically spams those two swords, and they had to break them to get like him to stop doing AoEs or something, right?
Yeah. Okay.
In a mobile game, you have like this mechanic. If you have the sword up, it's like your characters need to do 40 hits in like a turn-based kind of RPG to make sure that his sword does not activate his buffs. So if you do not do that in a turn base, he has reflect on. So the next turn, you basically kill yourself by attacking him.
Uh-huh.
So it's like a full of these things, right? And okay. I guess they're doing the best. I mean, like, how would you transition like from these weird mechanics from a mobile game into like an action RPG, right?
Yeah, but it must be very, very hard. I don't envy the boss encounter designers of like trying to figure out how to adapt those mechanics into this context. It's looking great. And they already gave a date for this, right?
Yeah,
they did. Okay, March 14th.
The Song and Siete is in April.
April, yeah.
They didn't really mention a date, but they say it'll come probably late April. And then there is character adjustments on the bottom. That's on the notes, and everyone's like, oh, are we finally like getting buffs to like the crappy characters like Gendoza or Gangadoza or whatever his name is? Because I think he's the most useless character in the current state of the meta right now.
I mean, when you have a game with 19 characters that all play pretty differently, I think the fact that they're going to adjust and balance, you know, nerf maybe, boost a couple of characters is totally expected, and they should do this. So
I expected it too. Everyone's like, oh, it's like, does that mean I don't get to use Vayne's cheesing mechanic to deal with Lucilius anymore? How his shield keeps us invincible? It's like, I'm sure they have to do something to make the fight interesting, right?
We'll see. They also mentioned there's going to be a part 3 Relink showcase on April 25th, which will probably clue us in on like when those characters will be released. And they're saying late April. So, you know, there's going to be more ongoing news, and we'll see. We'll see if they'll acknowledge, like, you know, that this game has done absurdly well, and if they plan to do more updates beyond their original 3 updates. Because that's the story with this game for a lot of its player base. It's like, we love this game so much, we want more things to do in it because we love it so much.
I think it's a side game's most successful game because they like, or console game is like, they open up like with the announcements, like how much they sell, with like a thank you art immediately.
Oh, really? That's good.
So it's like, they start with that, so you know it's doing good. I think the only thing that bugs me during the stream was like they were selling their official soundtrack to this game, and the only way to get the official soundtrack is to order from their store directly, and you cannot get that to ship to, like, they only ship, like, locally, so you have to, like, use a proxy to get that.
There's a, there's also, as part of, like, the free content that you're getting in the game, they're also adding new paid content for, like, it's really silly. It's like $3 packs. Like, one of them is like you pay $3 for the War Elemental Sigil, and then like 25 gold Dahlia badges and, you know, some mats.
That War Elemental, man. People don't want to deal with the grind anymore.
It's now they're going to pay that $3. It's kind of dumb that they're like, oh, you don't want to farm curios anymore? Well, just pay us $3 and you can have this.
Which That's elemental also is War Sigil again? Or War Elemental? Because I think I have some. Are they good?
War Elemental is every time you hit an opponent, you're dealing with the superior element. So, like, you're always getting, like, weakness hits on them. So,
dude, like, if it's huge for endgame.
Yeah. Yeah, so if, like, if they're, like, weak to fire, for example, and you're playing a character that's not fire-oriented, the War Elemental Sigil will make it so, like, every one of your hits is registered as fire. Towards that opponent, and if it's like if you're fighting against an opponent that's like weak to another element, then like having that War Elemental will always deal superior element damage, no matter what. So it's just a flat damage boost, pretty much for free. Yeah. So it's yeah. So if you don't want to grind Curios anymore, I guess there's that, and there's others too.
I think people are like so strong in the actual game right now. It's like, what is that one sigil that you kind of like automatically dodge everything, but your power is like reduced by like half?
I forgot the exact sigil name, but I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if you could just quit and just cheese through fighting Lucilius all day. It's like, oh, it's like a auto dodge.
I mean that, I guess it's just theoretical, right? So if you're still hitting damage cap even with a 50% damage penalty on that, you're still fine, but I imagine the Silius fight has to be done within a certain time frame before it goes to there's either a DPS race or like an enrage time.
Like a lot of these proud fights all have like a damage check mechanic at the end. It'll be like, oh. And I think that's like one of the biggest issues if you try to play like with the AI. You got to tell them, it's like, hey, don't use your Skybound art, because if you use that, I can't do this DPS check.
So it's right. Like, okay. They have to hold it. We'll see. That'll be coming out in a few days, and I'm sure I want to do it. I don't know if I'll have time to, but I definitely want to check it out.
I think it'll be a pretty short session. It's like you can just check it out, and then you could go back on to what main games you're working on at the moment. Yeah. So.
I'm sure some friends will be like, hey, you want to do this? I gotta check it out. Let's fucking kill this easy fight. Or maybe it's like fucking hard.
Well, Adam's caught up. He's been grinding.
Oh, shit. Yeah, we should fucking party up.
I mean, I assume he is. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, I've done pretty much everything you can do.
Did you get your did you get your weapon drop from the final fight?
I got all 19 of them.
Damn. What the fuck?
What a god! I mean, I did too, but I didn't know that he did too.
I also leveled up four of them to max, so I have a decent party of AI.
Yeah. Look,
I probably need some screenshots for those guys.
Adam, how many hours do you have in Relink? How many hundreds of hours?
But the thing is like
you've automated a bunch of this. Right. You've mentioned this.
Yeah.
So
he's playing like a real Grand Blue player. Really?
Look, he is ready. Like he's just like, it was easy. You know,
he was playing a mobile game. This guy would be.
Well, Adam was destroyed. Just like, I'm going to keep going until I hit a wall, and then he never hit a wall.
Look, if he was in the mobile
game, getting all those
Terminus
weapons didn't really take that long. It was
I'm
2 nights.
So. 2 nights?
Yeah, you're a very lucky man, then.
We have people in our crew, in our Grand Blue crew, that are complaining for 2 weeks that they can't find a drop for their main. It's like, oh, when's my main drop?
That is like,
this gets in 2 days.
Looks out like the fucking god farmer right here. Holy shit, that's funny. I'm just latching back a few weeks back before Adam started really. He's like, I won't really do much of the post game stuff or end game stuff. I'm, you know, it's just like I'll dabble with it, but I won't really, you know, go hard
and
on
he's
it.
Meanwhile, he's 100%. Meanwhile, he's literally completed everything.
I haven't got any supplementary damage. I haven't gotten any supplementary damage 5 sigils though.
Damn, that's true. So he's not done yet.
He was annoyed by the parrot.
I don't think you can get those from the parrot.
No, you can't. You know, those are curious.
Curious only.
Yeah. Okay, Adam, do you have your sound on mute or mute any part of the dialogue when you're opening up sigil stuff on the parrot?
I have a volume knob, literally 2 feet to my right, so I can just mute by turning down the volume for a moment.
So you don't want to hear the endless segoys and unbelievable.
Yeah,
it's wonderful for English voices.
It's wonderful and unbelievable in English.
Oh, okay. You'd still get unbelievable in the Japanese. Yes.
The relink stream is hilarious. Before the stream started, it was literally like the chat was spammed with like thousands of messages of unbelievable sugoi sugoi.
Hell yeah.
Emote, and it was like, damn.
And they didn't announce any fucking quality of life things to like let you like roll.
Nothing of that. I'm hoping that they will change that. Or at least you could open like, I don't know, maybe all Transmorrow at once instead of like sitting through all this like single rolls all day hearing that.
Or they're just gonna let people suffer and it'll just become fucking a meme forever. The side games method, you know.
The side games method. They'll train you, become a hardened veteran. I survived millions of sugoi and unbelievable.
It's obnoxious, man. Okay. Well, more relink to come. Coming one.
We have a couple trailer updates for some upcoming games. This first one showed up at the Xbox Partner Preview. I think this is the only thing that we have directly from the partner preview.
The Persona announcement was tied to it. Yeah, it's an Xbox exclusive, so.
Yeah, okay, anyways. This game is also not Xbox exclusive. So this is the first Berserker Kazan. This was first announced late last December. It was when we first covered it. And it had another new trailer at the Xbox partner preview, showing about 2 minutes of gameplay and talking a little bit about the gameplay styles, about how the character can wield either like an axe and a greatsword in each hand. I don't know if there was anything else like super meaningful to latch on to this. It seems like it's a Souls-like being published by Nexon and developed by Neopal. So I don't know. It looks interesting enough. We know it's coming out to PC, PS5, and Xbox Series, but no other release window or other details in that. But we did get just a little bit of extended gameplay look during this little trailer that they showed.
Looking a bit framey, you know, at certain parts of that trailer. It makes me really wonder. It's like, I don't know if this is the best footage to showcase and it's this framey, but okay. All right.
It is a little bit framey, yeah. But
sure, I mean, so stay tuned to whenever we, you know, when they announce a release date.
I feel kind of bad because I want to find something meaningful to like, to not just there's
really not. There's really not.
But I'm like, this looks like, imagine in your mind, a Souls-like. A character has a long blonde ponytail in like a winter castle environment. And whatever you think in your mind is probably pretty close to what's shown in this trailer.
I mean, hopefully the game's good. Like, hopefully the game's great.
Bone Halberd is pretty good. Yeah, hopefully the game's good. There's just nothing unique to latch onto here. But obviously we're still a ways out. It doesn't have a release window yet. Not even clearly slated for this year. But we have the gameplay trailer up on the site if you're interested in checking it out. We did get some more details about the upcoming Saga Emerald Beyond, both kind of like a written newsletter as well as a new character trailer. Late last January, we had a little bit of an introduction on one of the pairs of playable protagonists. Again, it's 5 playable protagonists, but 2 of them compared together. We had a trailer on Bonnie and Formina. And then this month, we had both a newsletter and a trailer for the vampire party member Sigunas. So we have a little bit about his story, about his, like, not as much in the trailer, but more so in the written little newsletter update post about how he's an undead character, he's a vampire, and he has a lot of specific gameplay mechanics tailored to that. He has, like, a party of 6 allies that all have names like Philosopher and Champion, like, kind of like class names that It's hard to parse directly from the details here, but there's like a thrall mechanic where you Sigunas can like steal blood from them to like empower himself.
Before we explain that, I can explain that later. But yeah, I do love the when the characters were first introduced, like you said, these brothers in arms called the generals. And like they're named after like kind of RPG class. I like when they introduce Warrior. Warrior's design is great because he has pink hair, has shades, and like you know when you think of a warrior in your head, you're like, okay, he's like a melee dude, right? When they show Warrior, he like pulls out a gun. it's like, okay, this is Warrior, and Hero has like a trident and whatnot. But so you're going to this like mechanics and. So in this game, they've been showing off new, there's like a wide variety of races in this game. And they have like unique mechanics in the way that they can like equip themselves and learn new skills and all sorts of stuff. And we've gone over it in like past newsletters for this game. So in this game, Siugnus is the one and only vampire in existence. And he has a whole slew of like very unique mechanics. As a vampire, obviously, to power up, they can suck on the blood and drain blood off of his party members, and that'll give him new arts called sanguine arts and like and also special skills called sanguine rolls. And he gets access to them by draining blood. So now he can actually allow party members to use these special sanguine moves, but here's the thing. So when you drain the blood off of a party member, that will put them in a thrall state. Now, there are these things called blood gear. If you give blood gear to people you've drained blood of that are now in thrall state, they will become a knight. So now these knights have higher life maximum life points and can use these sanguine moves. But if you remove the blood gear from these knights, they will turn them into wastrels. And wastrels are basically useless. Their life points are reduced down to one permanently, and they can no longer use these special sanguine things, and there's no way to restore a party member who has become a wastrel. They're basically permanently bricked if you take off the blood gear from these knights. And that's the entire mechanic. For a vampire, it's kind of like a two-step process. Like you can buff yourself up, but also you can buff your party members up at like a great risk, pretty much. And they have to like. There's a pretty like extensive breakdown of this in their like packet of the info for this, which is it's an entire mechanic just for one party or one protagonist, pretty much. The amount of like systems and unique mechanics per like party member in this game is like, it's very insane and very Saga, and Kawazu is a genius.
So Adam, I've only played one route of Scarlet Grace, which is the most contemporary. I've played like the Saga Frontier Remaster, which worked slightly differently, but in Scarlet Grace, were the four protagonists work that differently? Like they have obviously.
It was more about the structure of the game more than the character themselves.
Yeah, because
in Scarlet Grace,
reading the update with Bonnie and Fermina being like a pair of protagonists, and how Sigunas has this whole vampire aspect, it makes me eager to learn about the other two protagonists that we haven't really had a deep dive into yet. Because it just sounds like it's like, depending on your selection at the start, not only is it going to change your story significantly, but just literally like the core tenets of the gameplay are become available to you. So I'm really excited to see like the other characters, if they have something equivalent in terms of what's unique to their perspective.
Yeah, it all sounds and looks incredible, man. Like this Saga game looks fucking crazy. they feel like they're pulling out all the stops for this entry in Saga.
Yeah, it's like we keep joking that it's like, yeah, Emerald Beyond is going to be the real like RPG site game of the year, and it's like maybe not a joke. We'll see.
Who knows? We'll get our hands on it and get to play it. We'll find out. But yeah, there's a lot of good info.
We have not had a stinker or even like a mid game. Like everything this year feels like it's been a banger. Maybe not literally everything, but it's been crazy.
It's definitely something that even outside of like our sphere, like people in the wider industry have definitely noticed. It's like, yeah, this is a slower year for games, unless you're into RPGs, in which case, oh God, help.
Yeah, you know, I mean, yeah, for sure. Like, RPG fans have been fucking feasting, but they're Vince Tinkers, you know, they're Suicide Squad.
Yeah, Skull, but that's, but we don't,
that's not an
that.
RPG.
I know, I'm just saying, like, but they're definitely like, Vince Tinkers.
You know that it's been a banger year for RPGs where Alex didn't even feel the need to try and like even get someone to try and cover Suicide Squad. You just, that's like the perfect sign.
The stars have aligned.
He's eating good this year.
You're going to get Chow on it anyway, right, Chow?
What, writing Suicide Squad?
Yeah.
Cats?
No.
Can you imagine? At this point last year, we had like Wo Long, which was fine, but not excellent. We had obviously Forspoken, which had its own issues. We had like Wild Hearts, which was decent, but had a bad PC launch. Like, we had a bunch of like caveats, like this, but this, this, but this. This year, it's just like, oh God, there's so many games I want to play, and I don't have enough time.
Yeah, it's like this might seriously be like one of my favorite years in games ever. It's kind of shaping up to be one.
And to wrap up this podcast, we have kind of a rundown of release dates and upcoming important dates as normal. So a game that we talked about last week on the podcast, Vindictus Defying Fate. This is the single-player RPG from Nexon based on the MMO of the same name that released in 2010. We had a little bit of a detailed discussion on it last week. Well, they've announced that Vindictus Defying Fate will have an open pre-alpha playtest literally within the week on March 13th through Steam. So I think we knew they were going to have a playtest of some sort, but we didn't know any details about whether it was closed, open, how to access, how to sign up, whatever.
It was implied that it was open because they, gotcha. Yeah, they didn't say it was a closed test, and the wording made it sound like it was going to be open. We didn't know for sure.
But yeah, basically just says visit the store page, request access, download it, and play it. It basically seems like it's that simple. We're recording this podcast on the 9th. This pre-alpha is on the 13th. So by the time you're listening to this, if you're interested, you might be able to.
All right, Chow.
I'm gonna try it out. Yeah.
All right, Chow. You have one piece of homework for next podcast. Try Vindictus because both me and Josh are probably not going to have the time to give it enough time.
That's true. I'm definitely just going to dabble with it, but I don't know if I'll have like a lot of time to like check it out thoroughly. You know,
you hear that, Chow? You're the only one that can tell us if this game is shaping up to be good.
How am I supposed to know if I never even played the original Vindictus?
Well. Go download it.
Yeah, it's free to play. You can download it right now.
Log in, chat. We're just egging your boss.
Chow, if these guys bully you too much, you just gotta let them know. You gotta stand your ground.
I already have enough of my mobile games.
Well, we'll see. I mean, I definitely want to check it out, but
I know for sure I'm not going to have the time just because of
March is busy. Speaking of March being busy, Final Fantasy 14 will finally release on Xbox consoles, releasing for Xbox Series on March 21st.
It is still actually insane that Xbox players, if they actually want to play the game and not just a free trial, have to pay for Xbox Game Pass Core in addition to the fucking game sub. No other platform requires that. PlayStation, you don't have to have PlayStation Plus to play it.
I hope that doesn't make Sony change their minds. Like, oh, you need PS Plus to play FF14 now.
Imagine, dude. That'd be crazy.
Ooh.
I have to imagine that's like a breach of contract, though, so that's probably not that play.
Yeah.
But has anyone, or do you know anybody that touched the open beta? Or is it closed beta for that?
Open beta. So the funny thing about it is if you were an existing 14 player, you couldn't even try the game on Xbox during the beta.
That's why it's hard to know anybody that tried.
Yeah. So it's like, and I doubt anyone made a new account just to try it on Xbox. So I don't know.
This is truly targeting like Xbox exclusive.
But with the full release, do they allow you to import your character from other platforms into the Xbox?
Yes.
It's a universal thing? Okay.
Yes. It was just the open beta, for whatever reason, was completely unavailable to anyone that was already a player. So, yeah.
I imagine just that it's very, very similar to the PlayStation version. All it remains to see is, like, how does it hold up on the Xbox Series S?
I gotta assume that the Series X version might run a little bit better than the PS5.
Okay.
The only reason I would assume that is that 14 can be a bit CPU limited, and the Series X CPU is a bit faster. So,
but I wonder how it's gonna be like with Series S, and like if you're like a populated area in the game on Series S. I imagine it's still okay because it was designed for older hardware.
I'm going to open up YouTube, Final Fantasy 14 Xbox Series S Hunt Train. And let's see if anything pops up. Nope. Well, we'll never know.
Oh, that's it. It's over. It's a mystery to everyone.
Launching on April 2nd, we get Astra Knights of Veda. We last covered this during the last Steam NextFest in late summer of last year. So this is a game that'll be on PC and mobile. Otherwise, I believe
Chow played this.
I was going to say, like, was it Josh? No, it was Chow.
It was me. I just wrote it because I was frustrated. I was like I see this Genshin UI. I see this monetization. I see the same RNG gearing. I'm like, oh my god, I'm so mad. I gotta write an article about this.
That's pretty good. It got you to write an article. Like you got so mad that like you had to write about it.
They did mention like on their full release, they're gonna change the gearing to be a little bit more easy. But they mentioned nothing about the monetization and stuff. So I'm guessing that's gonna stay. That's kind of like what I'm seeing from this whole development message. So not really looking forward to it. I mean, the game was, besides like the monetization and the gearing, I thought the game left a pretty decent impression.
The art looks incredible.
It's like a Dragon Crown made into a, to gacha game sort of thing, right?
That's the bad part. It's like, hey, everything seems to be shaping up, but seems like the gacha aspect is not looking great. I mean, the big things that they mentioned, like they're adding autoplay to it to automate some of the grinding, increase drop rates for some shit. They have multiple ways now to Starstones like the gacha currency in this game. Is Starstones the gacha currency in Astra?
Yes, if I believe so. I already kind of forgot what they're called, but you kind of exchange for like two different rolling currencies, and those rolling currencies, like, oh, this is used for our limited banner, this is used for the standard banner where you get no limited characters, right? And so it's like, yeah, they just copied the Genshin system one to one. It's like, if you fail to get this one, the next time it's guaranteed to get it, you know? But
are you rolling for characters or weapons or both?
They have separate banners for them.
Oh, okay, so Genshin. Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. Good luck, I guess. I don't know. I probably will not check it out after what you've said about it.
Yeah, like I said, it's like it's a monetization that scared me away.
Makes sense.
Also releasing in April, we're getting the release of an indie card-based tactical RPG called Dream Tactics. So this is a game that has, I don't know if it's RPG Maker, but it is an RPG Maker style overlay and art style, and uses a card-based battle system with some interesting and kind of fun, flavorful, almost like Magical Girl 2D art style for it. So coming out mid-April for PC, it seems pretty fun. We did get a release date for this July. We knew that this was coming this summer, but we finally got a release date for it, and that is The Legend of Heroes Trails Through Daybreak, the localized version of Kuro no Kiseki. We'll be releasing in the West on July 5th. And I think for the people here, that really only pertains to me, because Adam is behind and everyone else has already played it. So
yep.
I might replay like the localized version, because I actually really like this game a lot. So
yeah, I like it quite a bit. I am curious about the dub. I don't know if I will replay it, just because I have homework I need to slot in somewhere before Kai no Kiseki comes out so I can send an email to Falcom. So it's like, probably around when this comes out, I'll be playing Kuro 2 finally.
I'll put my full attention of fully doing the guide once I'm done with Rebirth and finish Relink, I guess.
Did you start a Kuro guide? I did.
I wrote, but it's like so inconsistent. Like I wrote some chapters and some chapters are like blank. It's like it's like out of order, and I'm just gonna go back and fix it as I replay it.
But yeah, for anyone that hasn't played this game in English already, because I do know there is that like fan patch and whatnot, this is still probably my favorite in the series. It's really good. It is undoubtedly like even like most people I know, it's like top three. This is
that's one of their best ones. Definitely one of the best.
It literally washed out a lot of the sour taste I have with the Cold Steel left off, right? I didn't even touch Reverie due to how bitter I was about that game.
Reverie is good. It's not perfect, but it's good.
Yeah, but this thing is like, when I was playing, I was like, oh my god, it's like, Trails is so back, baby.
He's so back.
And then, like, and then people are like telling me, it's like, but Kuro 2 is no good. I'm like, are you sure?
I won't say anything. I told you I will not say anything about Kuro 2.
As has been established, Josh is eagerly waiting for me to get to Kuro 2, so he has someone to vent about the game with.
I already do. Like my friend and I talk about it a lot. It's just like we kind of. I think a few weeks after like he played that game, like he just got out a Google Doc and like blank Google Doc, like started like listing everything wrong about that game, and it's like, yep.
Oof.
So I'm just like, man.
And that covers us for upcoming important dates and release dates. We will unfortunately have to end this podcast on a very sad, bittersweet note. And this has been going through the news throughout the week. And that is that Dragon Ball mangaka, Dragon Quest artist and creator Akira Toriyama has passed away at the age of 68. He passed away on March 1st, as reported by the official Dragon Ball Twitter and his agency earlier this week. So obviously a creator whose impact on basically like the worldwide proliferation of Japanese art in general cannot really be understated. Just the impact that he's had on manga, on comics, on creators for the last 30 years.
This isn't even like a perfect comparison, but he's definitely, for lack of a better term, our generation's like Walt Disney in terms of impact, if not more so. Like, honestly, like,
it's more so to me. It's like,
yeah, it's like
he was my entire childhood, and I felt depressed about.
If you look at the worldwide impact that Dragon Ball alone, not even counting Dragon Quest, which obviously for us is the bigger one because of how it basically has inspired like so much of the RPGs that have come since, but like Dragon Ball, like probably over a billion people know what Dragon Ball is or have been influenced by it in some way. It's, you cannot overstate just how like large of a legacy that he leaves behind.
Even people that are not into video games, even my brother was depressed hearing this news, and he just couldn't work all day hearing this. It's so depressing to hear this. Like, it was, he has like so many projects that he was working on as well. It's just like, it's just sudden. It's kind of like out of nowhere. It's not.
I have to admit that kind of like how I was talking about with Aiden like a few weeks ago, like I was not originally planning on playing Sandland at launch, but now it's like, well, I kind of have to now. It's like the last major thing he worked on before he passed. It's like, shit.
And I have a couple comments, and like one of the things that really hit me, which I wasn't expecting it to, but it did, is that of course throughout social media, throughout all the forums and Reddit and Twitter, there's been a lot of fan art, a lot of a lot of well wishes, a lot of sadness, and a lot of remembrance. One of the ones that I wasn't expecting to hit me as hard as it did was there was a social tweet from like a European soccer league that showed just a bunch of photos of soccer players like posing in different like recognizable Dragon Ball like poses. And that just right there just showed like how wide the impact is. This isn't just comic fandom or anime fandom or video game fandom. It's just fandom people in general, just how much of an impact he had. And then I saw someone else like word it like, there's always kind of like this statement where it's like, well, Dragon Ball is, for lack of a better word, kind of normie in a way. But I say this with complete endearment, is that he is likely, Akira Toriyama is likely your favorite mangaka's favorite mangaka, just in terms of like the number of people that he's impacted. And we've seen, obviously, well wishes from creators like Sakaguchi, Oda, Kishimoto, several that I'm forgetting Yujihori. Right now. Like,
And Dragon like, Quest 12 is gonna,
it's gonna be weird.
And then, you know, there's some through lines that are more obvious than others. Like, of course, current people like Oda or Kishimoto mentioned like how much Akira Toriyama inspired them, but also things that you weren't expecting, like Mario's Tanuki Run being inspired by Arale,
Dr. Slump,
and Dr. Slump, just like stuff like that.
I think Cloud's
outfit being inspired by Gohan's in the Cell games. It's just all over the place.
I think, and this was an older tweet that people just retweeted after the fact, but there was this one tweet where it's like, one by one, the generations march for heroes to face Goku. Tell me this, if they could beat Goku, why does Goku remain the man to beat decades later? His real victory is his opponents fade. And it's a jokey tweet, but it really says it all. It's like, yeah, it's like the legacy of Dragon Ball is like eternal.
I think the most favorite thing I see from him is that he's playing Dragon Quest with his son. Like, there's like a little picture of him playing his son's like, hey, look, I worked on this. Or the other one is the Chrono Trigger development room. It's like a little message if you get there saying the, telling his kids, like, if you see this, it's like, I made it. Are you having fun? Or something like that. You could tell he was a great dad.
I struggled to find the words to even vocalize like how I felt when I like heard of his death. I thought about this a lot after, you know, hearing it, and I thought long and hard just like about just the mortality of like our favorite creators. Like I thought of, you know, the recent death of Yoshitaka Moriyama, you know, just when we heard the word of that a month ago. And I think about like, you know, Kazuki Takahashi, the creator of Yu-Gi-Oh, when he passed away several years ago.
And Takahashi thing too, wasn't it? Like it came out he was trying to rescue
save someone. So trying to save someone distressed in the ocean. It's devastating. Like, you know, these people, they created art like no other. You know, it highlights the impact of like why you need real humans all striving and motivated and striving and always reinventing what art is, you know, and it's just like you can't replicate that with machines. You can't replicate what these people and countless other artists who have come and gone are still with us, like having that human element with art is so, it's integral to our, you know, our fundamental existence as human beings. Seeing how Toriyama's art style has inspired multiple generations of people around the world, when to many, 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 many people internationally, when you think of the manga art style, they think of Toriyama's designs. He was a beautiful human being that it cannot be stated enough how much of an impact he left on the world, on the entire human race. And it's just, fuck me.
I think Oda's eulogy for him is what broke me.
Mm-hmm.
Where it was like, may heaven be as joyous a world as he envisioned. It was like, oh, yeah. God, fuck.
Like, you see it in every one of his works. From Sandland, from entirety of Dragon Ball, Dr. Slump, countless others. There's always that underlying theme among all of them that he believed in people. above all else.
The spirit bomb. Like, the entire concept of the spirit bomb is, like, the hopes and... just fuck, man.
Yeah. He always tried to convey that message. It's like, no matter how grim things are, trust in people. Trust in the people that you love. They will help you get you through the life's toughest challenges. And it's just like...
You could even see it in Vegeta, where it's like the whole, like the, his whole character arc is he becomes reformed because of the love of his family. And it's like, shit.
Yeah. Like, way too soon, man. Way too soon. God bless.
Yeah, 68. We should have had Toriyama for another 15 or 20 years. And unfortunately, we don't know details, but it was a head injury of some sort that he succumbed
to. There's.
It might speculate, like, I won't speculate exactly.
Yeah.
How exactly it went down.
Yeah. All we know is that it was like hematoma, and there was a report that he was sick since last year. So it might have been related, but we don't know for sure.
Yeah. On top of, like, you know, on the upcoming release of Sandland, there's also a new Dragon Ball Daima series. Still in development.
The return of the Sparking series or Budokai series.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Of course, the long-awaited whatever Dragon Quest is coming
out. Dragon Quest Evolve and 3 HD.
Yeah, and whatever. Yeah, any other related races. It's gonna be. It's. He was working on so much stuff. It's like it's a large void now. That like obviously some of these are already completed, like Sandland, but who knows how long far about all the other works are.
Well. Sandland wasn't completed. He was working on a follow-up.
Oh, but was it a follow-up? There's a follow-up?
Yeah, it was a follow-up.
Okay. Wow.
Because, like, half the reason why we got the movie and we're getting the game is that he wanted to re-explore the IP and expand upon it.
Wow, I didn't even know about that. It's, rest in peace, Akira Toriyama. You will forever be remembered by hundreds of millions of people. Hell of a legacy.
Potentially a billion people, like Josh. Impact is that wide.
Exactly.
But yeah, there was
another one that broke me was Toyotaro, who currently draws the Dragon Ball Super manga. Says this is a rough translate, but I think it captures the meaning. It's anyways. My voice is gonna crack reading this. I apologize.
Okay.
Yeah. I drew manga because I wanted to be praised by Toriyama sensei. It was everything to me.
That's a common sense.
Rest in peace. So appropriate that we will end this on a moment of silence for Toriyama. Thank you all so much for listening. You can find us, you know where to find us. And we'll be back next week. Stay safe and take care.